Prepare yourselves for Ethan and Aaron's Confessions of a Movie Snob, the ongoing discussion of film genres.
Everything's right in the world. We got McGee back.
Yes, everything is balanced in the universe again.
Hello, sir.
Good evening. How are you guys doing?
Well enough.
Doing good.
Lots of craziness going on here. Having an Oscar party this weekend, so I'm trying to get the house ship shape and should be good, but I'm sore from pushing around that big-ass carpet shampooer and, you know, moving couches and stuff like that. But
if Aaron's actually, like, cleaning and stuff,
it hurts.
Amusing.
It hurts.
Oh, the rest of us are going to be like, where's the TV?
It's over there.
Sweet.
All right. But we are having this Oscar show this week, and if you've been listening to our shows at all, I think we've talked Oscar, or at least award-winning movies for
two, three shows
now. And we're going to go to the bottom of the barrel now. And we're going to go to something. This is a Christopher suggestion, and I like it a lot. Basically, we're going to go with our guilty pleasure movies. Movies that suck, but we like them anyway.
It's a very organic type of a creation. Because every time we've had you on, McGee, we've always mentioned at least one or two movies. Like, this movie's a guilty pleasure to me.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, it's Ash Wednesday. It's the day that I'm supposed to feel guilty about something. It might not be about my cinematic tastes.
That's true.
But before we get into any of that, we have a little news segment where we, like, talk about
geekly happenings. News that's relevant to us geeks. Featuring reactions by Aaron.
What's going on this week, Ethron?
Oh, let's see. The latest stuff that I've got is apparently, you know, they're working on a Lone Ranger movie.
Yes,
Gore Verbinski is directing it. Apparently, William Fichtner has landed the role of the lead villain in The Lone Ranger.
I like him.
He replaces the previously rumored Dwight Yoakam as Butch Cavendish, described by Verbinski as Don Quixote told from Sancho Panza's point of view. The film is going to star Armie Hammer as, obviously, the Lone Ranger, with Johnny Depp as Tonto, and it's also going to... And then we drop things. And then we... it's also going to star Ruth Wilson, Helena Bonham Carter, James Badge Dale, Barry Pepper, Tom Wilkinson, James Frain, and that's it. That's announced. It's nice to see Barry Pepper and, you know, being back in movies since his nosedive in Battlefield Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about awful movies right there.
That is not going to be on my list.
Redeem him?
What's that?
Saving Private Ryan didn't redeem him?
He did Saving Private Ryan before he did Battlefield Earth.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to talk about a redemptive movie, I liked him in True Grit.
No, that's true.
Yeah, he was pretty good. I mean... There's nothing to
he's
you know,
good,
write
he's
home
good.
About.
I really
good
like him.
He's
in
a good character
Ryan,
actor.
So
yeah.
I love him in Saving Private Ryan. Let's see.
I don't really have anything to say about that.
Yes.
I mean, I knew they were going to get back on track with it. I mean,
yeah.
I don't see it doing well. I keep saying it. I'm going to say it again. It's this decade's Dick Tracy.
Sure.
It's going to be the thing that...
I have some more faith in it. I just watched Rango yesterday, and that was actually really good.
Told you.
It's a fun Western. Yeah, I liked it. And it's Gore Verbinski. So, okay. Now on to A Good Day to Die Hard, the Die Hard 5, the next Die Hard sequel. Jai Courtney apparently is going to be playing Jack McClane, which is, of course, John McClane's son.
He's that guy from Rome, or not Rome.
Entourage, I think.
No, Spartacus. He's in Spartacus, isn't he?
Jai Courtney?
Yeah.
I didn't recognize him from Spartacus.
Thought he was. I could be wrong.
Following a global casting search, Jai Courtney has nabbed the coveted role of Jack McClane, or John McClane Jr., the son of Bruce Willis's iconic hero in A Good Day to Die Hard.
Was Shia LaBeouf busy or something?
Apparently he may be doing Transformers 4 or something. I don't know. But apparently he wasn't up for this, or they went in a different direction. It looks like it puts McClane on an international stage, truly a New York City fish out of water in Moscow, and introduces his estranged son, Jack, an apple that has not fallen far from the tree. Jack may even be more of a hard ass than his father. Despite their differences, they must work together to keep each other alive and the world safe for democracy. The film begins production this April for a February 14th, 2013 release. See, the movies keep upping it.
Valentine's
Day, yeah. Because, you know, the first movie was a building, the second movie was an airport, the third movie was a city, the fourth movie was the nation, the fifth movie's going to have to be the world, The sixth movie is going to be The Fifth Element, so it'll be the universe. And then they can't go further than that, or they could start doing realities.
Or
and
dimensions.
Then it becomes The Matrix.
There you go.
So, yeah. I like the last Die Hard movie. It was at least entertaining.
Yeah, so, it was what it was.
For your Die Hard, it was fun.
I like the third one a lot.
Oh, yeah. With Samuel Jackson and Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he played Varro in Spartacus.
Nice. And we are all fans of Kolchak the Night Stalker, right?
Sure.
I know I am.
I am.
I'm pretty sure you are, McGee.
Oh, I absolutely adore it.
Well, you know they're working on a movie.
Indeed, yes.
Apparently it's a Walt Disney big screen version of the Night Stalker, and now it's apparently shepherded in by Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp really wants to do it. But Aaron just told me about this, and I spotted the article that Edgar Wright is going to is now attached to direct The Night Stalker. With Johnny Depp attached to star, that makes me very intrigued to see that.
It sounds weird, but you know, I'm cool with that.
My only question is Edgar Wright writing it.
I don't know.
So
my question is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Night Stalker can just go jump off a bridge if this gets in the way of End of the World. I want that movie.
Yes.
I really want that movie.
There is that. Well, Wright's sort of really blown up the last couple of years. So.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you know what's really intriguing about this?
Mm.
What's that?
They've already gotten the crappy Night Stalker reboot out of the way with the god-awful mid-aughties television series. You know, so
with Stuart Townsend in it. Oh.
Yeah,
he's.
Yeah,
fuck, I would never put him in a movie.
This is a TV series on ABC.
So, I mean,
I wouldn't put him on a home video. I mean, he fucks everything up that he's in.
Well, as I was saying, they've gotten the horrible reinvention out of the way. Isn't like in the cycle of things? Isn't this movie going to be the palate cleanser that restores the franchise?
I hope so. I mean, it's hard to replace Darren McGavin, though.
It's impossible.
You know, I just don't see him doing it. Johnny Depp is really good. Okay,
Johnny Depp is weird.
Johnny Depp can, when he wants to act, he can kick some ass. Okay, he can do it. But I don't know. Darren McGavin is a hard act to follow.
But I will tell you this much. There is a very, at least to me, obvious way of how to do it and get past the seemingly insurmountable fact that, you know, Darren McGavin's not going to be in this one.
Yeah.
If they go back to the original novel, Kolchak is a significantly different character that I think would play a lot more interesting on the screen than just Johnny Depp trying to do a Darren McGavin impression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if he does that, I'm sure it'll be fine. But if they actually have the guts and the foresight to go back in the original novel, I think they could give us a Carl Kolchak that's different enough from Darren McGavin, but it still can be a compelling character.
Yeah, my only thing with that is I don't think enough people will realize that they're doing that. They're going to automatically associate it with the old TV series.
I want to say, I don't think modern audiences know Kolchak.
Thank you. Exactly what I was getting ready to say.
So I don't think that they're really tied down to anything. I think they should just do what they what they feel is organic with the script and, you know, what they get out of their talent.
Yeah, you guys are right. I thought, you know, probably there are, I by no means am an average type of viewer.
And neither am
I. Out of it, so.
Yeah, I know it really well, too. But I also know that, you know, Chet the idiot frat boy doesn't know who the fuck Kolchak is, but he'll go
Let
see a Johnny Depp movie.
He doesn't even know who the fuck Darren McGavin is.
Well, I'm sure they've seen The Christmas Story.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, you know, I'm interested. At least, I mean, Edgar Wright attached to it. That could mean it won't suck. So.
Yeah. Let's just get some Nick Frost and Simon Pegg in there, too, while we're at it. And
yes. I'm all for that.
Put some aliens in it. Hey, this is End of the World.
Hey.
There we go. It's going to be Sean and Ed with Kolchak and aliens. That would rule.
Nice.
Maybe that wouldn't rule.
Oh, gosh. This is some interesting news. We've talked Netflix before.
This is cool.
Netflix and the Weinstein Company announced a multi-year film agreement today that will include Oscar-nominated films The Artist and Undefeated. Netflix Incorporated, the Weinstein Company, today announced a new multi-year licensing agreement that will make foreign language, documentary, and certain other movies from the Weinstein Company exclusively available for Netflix members in the U.S. to watch instantly. The Artist, the most honored film of the year with 17 awards for Best Picture and 10 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture, will make its pay TV debut exclusively on Netflix rather than on traditional premium cable. That's actually kind of huge, I think.
It's gigantic. This really makes up for the loss of Stars.
Yeah. And we knew they were doing, they were working on extra stuff. So
they, yeah,
you know, Weinstein stuff. Hey,
I mean, it's great. They're going to show The Artist. I mean, I'm going to buy that the second it comes out. But sure, it's great. This will give other people an opportunity mm-hmm. to see it that aren't as brave as, well, I don't know, brave. But I actually saw it and I love it, and I will mm-hmm. buy this shit out of the Blu-ray when it comes out. So
cool. Let's see. Three more cast members have joined the film version of Ender's Game. The cast for Gavin Hood's adaptation of Orson Scott Card's sci-fi
novel. I didn't realize
novel.
That was Gavin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah. Has been coming together fairly quickly. The big addition is Nonso Anozi.
Cool.
In the mix playing Sergeant Dapp, according to Deadline.
And Nonso Anozi is?
Yes. Yes, he is. A person on this planet.
I know the name. Just keep talking.
Yeah.
I'll look it up.
He is. The site also reports that Stevie Ray Dallimore and Andrea Powell will also play the parents of Ender Wiggins, who's being played by Hugo star Asa Butterfield, a young strategist drafted to save the human race. Anozie.
I know that name.
Yeah, so do I. Was last seen in Joe Carnahan's thriller The Gray.
Yep.
But the British character actor could be seen in everything from Guy Ritchie's Rock and Rolla to Mike Leigh's Happy Go Lucky to last year's Conan the Barbarian. So, character actor, it sounds like. So, some more for that. I mean, I think the biggest coup for this movie is they got Harrison Ford.
He was. Yeah, I mean, we knew that. That's been news for a while.
Yeah, but that's still the biggest news about the movie mm-hmm. to me.
He was artist in Conan. He was. Yep, he was Tank and Rock and Rolla. As soon as you said that, okay, I remember that. He's a black guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, nice. yeah, that guy. Remember him, Tank?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's awesome.
Nice.
Oh, okay, cool.
Let's see. I liked the movie Red. I thought it was a hell of a lot of fun.
Sure.
It was. It was directed by Robert Schwentke. Well, the sequel, Red 2, appears to be Red Harder. Is being directed by Dean Parisot, or Dean Pariseau, depends on how you want to pronounce that. Let's see. Obviously, Red was based on a comic book by Warren Ellis and Kelly Hammer. Now, this is the interesting thing. It says Bruce Willis, Morgan Freeman, John Malkovich, and Helen Mirren are all expected to reprise their roles as the team of CIA operatives who are classified, retired, extremely dangerous. But Morgan Freeman, like, died in the first one.
It's Morgan fucking Freeman.
Yeah,
he can come back.
That's true. Let's see. Parasite is best known for directing 1999's Galaxy Quest.
Right on.
His last theatrical feature was 2005's Fun with Dick and Jane. The Summit Entertainment release is expected to enter production later this year, targeting an August 2nd, 2013 release. I like the first one. So, you know.
The first one what?
Red.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it doesn't really scream it needs a sequel to me, but, I mean, if it looks entertaining.
That's true.
You know, I mean, I don't.
Now, this is kind of cool for me just because when I was a kid, I have fond memories of coming home from kindergarten and sitting with a bowl of macaroni and cheese, sitting with my mom and watching reruns of Perry Mason on you know, TBS, okay? I love Perry Mason.
That's well declared, yeah.
Yeah, I love Perry Mason. It's, you know, Raymond Burr who can really top that. Well, it was announced a couple months back that Robert Downey Jr. was working on a Perry Mason movie.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, now Mark Guggenheim is negotiating to write the script for the Warner Brothers Perry Mason, which is a potential starring vehicle for Robert Downey Jr.
His agent Satan came through for him again, huh?
Apparently. Downey is also producing with his wife and partner Susan Downey and their banner under their banner Team Downey, along with Robert Cort. Guggenheim is writing a script based off an original story by Downey and Team Downey president David Gambino. Based on the original Earl Stanley Gardner books, Perry Mason will be set in the 1930s and feature characters such as Mason's secretary Della Street, private investigator Paul Drake, and Mason's longtime courtroom nemesis Hamilton Berger. I love the Perry Mason TV series and those 3,000 TV movies.
I've never watched it, I don't think.
We're talking guilty pleasures today. It is totally a guilty pleasure for me.
I've always heard it's good.
I mean, it's such a fundamentally 50s cliched, you know, courtroom
mm-hmm.
Series. But I mean, it made Raymond Burr a household name. So I mean, the show ran for like 9 years, 10 years, it ran forever. And it's just great. At least they used to be, actually now that Starz is off of Netflix, you probably can't. But all the TV movies used to be on Netflix. I don't think they are anymore since Starz. I think they were Starz.
Mm. Mm. Well, that sucks.
Yeah, which is too bad. Let's see. Warner Brothers is, or Deadline is reporting that the studio, that Warner Brothers has closed deals with Akiva Goldsman and Will Smith's Overbrook Entertainment to make another I Am Legend. The original was made for about $150 million, earned a massive $585.3 million worldwide. According to the site, quote, the intention is for Will Smith to reprise his role. Yeah, is to make lots of money. And reprise his role as scientist Robert Neville, who is the last man on Earth doing battle with a mutated mob in New York City after an apocalyptic man-made virus wiped out the population. Arash Amel, upcoming the expatriate and
so would it be a
Monaco,
prequel? Would it be a prequel?
No, I'm getting to that. Okay. Has hired to this Arash Amel, who did The Expatriate and The Grace of Monaco, has been hired to write the script. Deadline adds that the film is not being called a prequel. So it is right now being assumed it's a sequel, straight sequel.
Did he take his explosion pills before the end of that movie or something?
He was in a refrigerator. That's what they're going to open with. He pops out of a refrigerator.
There you go.
See, I can't remember. I hope so. I remember there was the alternate ending. I can't remember which one was which because I haven't seen it.
I thought that there was an I thought he died in an explosion in the end of the movie.
See, I'm thinking that might have been the alternate ending. I can't remember. Yeah, I think he did. I can't remember. I don't know.
He died. I know he died. He definitely died.
The movie was okay. I really liked him in it. He was really good.
We've talked about it. They fucked it up with the Hollywood ending.
Oh, yeah. They fucked up the Hollywood ending. And they made them monsters instead of, you know, not monsters.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of crazy. But
well, maybe they can fix it with maybe they can fix it with the sequel. They'll actually like do the original ending where he realizes he's the motherfucker.
But if it's a sequel, I'm just like, the fuck? Whatever. Okay.
All right. Well, I got to ask you before we go any further.
Sure.
You've done Mark Guggenheim.
Uh-huh.
You've done Akiva Goldsman.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Are we doing any Michael Bay news tonight? Because him and Uwe Boll are the only ones we've missed so far.
I think last time we mentioned that Transformers 4 is happening. And Uwe Boll, the only thing I can really mention about him is I spotted that he did another In the Name of the King movie direct-to-video, which is terrifying. We were just talking box office gross and whatnot and how on one of the other shows that we like, Bagged and Boardcast, they were going on and on about how Green Lantern was a box office bomb, when really it wasn't a bomb, it just about broke even.
More appointment, really.
Yeah, yes. No. Our problem with the whole thing was the vernacular.
Because
we're not saying it was a huge success, but it broke even.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't by any means a huge bomb.
It wasn't Cutthroat Island bombing.
No. And like I was pointing out, you know, it's Uwe Boll's movies, you know, like In the Name of the King was made for like $40 million. It made like 12 worldwide. I mean, and I think, though, what was the other one that he did that was even worse? It was Blood Rain.
Blood Rain 2, wasn't it?
No, Blood Rain 2 was direct-to-video, but Blood Rain, the first Blood Rain, I think was made for $20 million and made 3.
Yeah.
And that's worldwide.
But he used that tax write-off
thing.
Well,
and they've closed those loopholes now, so now he can
go to hell.
Thankfully, he can stop theatrically releasing movies. And
I'm actually, you know, McGee, I'm a movie snob. And I have never seen an Uwe Boll movie, and it's not because of the fact that they're Uwe Boll movies. They've just never interested me. I haven't avoided them, and I've never sought them out. So,
well, isn't that the ultimate cinematic crime? I mean, there are plenty of many bad filmmakers out there. We'll probably talk about a few tonight, but you know, at least you know Ed Wood, who's supposed to be the worst filmmaker of all time. His films are just so bizarre.
Yeah,
they have this wonderful hypnotic quality of them.
Yes.
Now, when you're a bad filmmaker and you manage to be flat out boring at the same time, to me that's all the degree of crime.
Well, there's bad, and then there's mockably bad, and his movies aren't even mockably bad.
I say it all the time, Christopher. I would rather hate a movie than not care about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen I think I've only seen two of his movies, and that was enough.
What was that one that that guy with the glasses reviewed?
Alone in the Dark.
Yeah.
I've seen that one, and it was terrible.
I had a hard time watching the review because the movie was so bad.
Oh, yeah. It's bad. Yeah. And I've seen House of the Dead, which was also awful. Yeah. So, and basically after some of my friends we'd go out and rent like bad movies to mock, and that was one we tried to mock and failed because it was so bad. Yeah.
Well,
and when it reaches that point, you just go, "Yeah, this is just awful." You know, it's the so bad that you're laughing at it and making fun of it, and they're so bad that it just pisses you off. Yeah.
Well, we've talked Goldsmith. We talked. Who else did we talk?
Mark Guggenheim.
Guggenheim. Yeah.
Okay, Mark Guggenheim. But and we don't have any Michael Bay. We don't have any Uwe Boll. Okay. But we do have a little bit of Sacha Baron Cohen. Does that work?
That's all right.
That'll work.
Well, I think he's one of the more interesting artists working today.
He is certainly interesting, and as much as he is interesting, he's probably doubly that obnoxious.
I would agree with that.
But I do think he's very, very, very talented.
Yes.
So, and this stupid story doesn't want to load.
Well, he can at least
but basically, what's going on?
He's a good director.
What's going on with Sacha Baron Cohen is he was pegged to be a. Presenter at the Academy Awards this Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent out a request that he wants to appear as his character from The Dictator when he's giving out his thing, and they revoked his tickets.
Nice.
For wanting to... But basically, you know, I don't really care about the fact that he wants to show up as The Dictator. That doesn't bother me. To me, it's just a publicity stunt.
Yeah.
Because that movie doesn't come out till May, and so obviously he's just trying to get word out on it.
Mm-hmm.
So... you know, that's my thing about it, is I don't care about, you know, because, you know, they always do, like, silly little things like that. And we also, I think we've already reported that Miss Piggy and Kermit the Frog are presenting an Oscar as well.
That's awesome.
I'm okay with it not being serious. I just don't like the heavy-handed marketing.
Sure.
If you see it as a marketing thing, I could totally get that. But you know, there's all that. You also can't rule out the Academy as like, oh no, we might have somebody on here more edgy than Billy Crystal.
No, see, I don't have a problem with that at all. My problem, I don't like the marketing aspect of it. I mean,
I'm totally down with that interpretation. But let's face it, the Academy is not going to put itself in a situation where anything more dangerous than Billy Crystal makes it on the air. I think they'd be genuinely terrified of what he would do in character before a live mic.
Yeah, but he doesn't need to have that beard on to do crazy stuff, you know.
Yeah,
that's true. But you know, there's just something about him when he's in character. He seems to have much greater license to pursue these sort of things. And like I said, I'm not saying the Academy is unjustified not wanting to stick a live microphone into an in-character Baron Cohen.
Okay, that's why it didn't load.
But I'm just saying the notion, in addition to the crass commercial, it offends their inherent conservatism.
It wouldn't load because they were updating the story. He is not banned from the Oscars, but they do not want him to do the dictator thing. Because it was a news story. Basically, they said, "Okay, you can come to the Oscars, but don't do that, dude." You know.
No.
So we'll see what happens, and I'm sure he'll be very well. He'll be very well behaved and stuff like that.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, speaking of bad ideas, Gael García Bernal is going to be Zorro Reborn. Fairbanks.
Wasn't he just reborn?
Yes, but this is a worse idea.
Zorro in space, right?
Douglas Fairbanks, Guy Williams, and Antonio Banderas and others have played the iconic swashbuckling character of Zorro, but now a new name can be added to that list, as Variety is now saying that Mexican actor Gael García Bernal from Y tu Mama También,
that's a good-ass movie,
will be donning the mask of Zorro for a new futuristic reboot from 20th Century Fox. A few months back, Sony hired writers to reboot their Zorro franchise, but 20th Century Fox has decided to move ahead with their own Zorro project, tentatively titled Zorro Reborn, which won't be set either in California or Mexico, but will have Bernal Zorro as a masked vigilante looking for revenge. It's in a post-apocalyptic future.
Okay, that's right.
Oh, great.
Written by Glenn Gears, Lee Shipman, and Brian McGreevy, the project is still looking for a director.
I'll do it. How hard could that be? Yeah. I can fuck up a movie.
Okay, we were talking about things from my childhood. Another rerun that I really enjoyed was the Guy Williams Zorro.
That was a good show.
Fuck 20th Century Fox for trying to do that.
So basically the Zorro fights zombies guys are trying to beat probably the Zorro fights vampires movie to the screen, right?
Probably, yes, yes. And for what I know, since Sony is rebooting Zorro, they're getting Neveldine and Taylor to do it or something crap. And I'm just like, yeah, let's just ruin all that. And I wanted to say screw Disney for putting out limited editions of the Zorro TV series on DVD season 1 and season 2. And now you can't find them for less than $180 each.
Wow.
They're bastards.
Oh, well, that's a bit of torrents for.
Unless one were to resort to other methods, which
no.
Disney is in no way encouraging.
And I have tried those methods, and you can only find them colorized online.
Ooh.
And I refuse to watch it in colorized, because that is an abomination unto reality and God, if there is one. Anyway.
Well, you're talking 20th Century Fox. Let's go let the other part of the crazy and just talk some Fox News.
Woo.
Fox News declares the Lorax is indoctrinating your children.
Nice.
I haven't really read this over too much, but basically what Lou Dobbs, everybody knows Lou Dobbs, right? He's fucking crazy. But Lou Dobbs claims that liberal media is ignoring the so-called plot. The plot that he is speaking of is his plot of President Obama, who is using all of these children's movies to indoctrinate young children to be, into supporting environmental causes and occupy Wall Street. He claimed that the media is ignoring that plot that is plainly demonizing the so-called 1% and espousing the virtue of green energy policies come what may. How this seems to boil down is that Dobbs feels that 4-inch borrowers at the center of the secret world of... they're also seeing the secret world of Arity, who scraps from humans to... scrape from humans to live are meant to represent the 99% of the OWS movement. First off, blah, 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 blah. But basically, we talked about this before. Was it the Muppets?
Yes.
The Muppets and something else. So, personally, I don't get it.
I personally liked how the Muppets fight back at them. Was kind of amusing. Their British premiere.
That was pretty funny. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, that was funny.
But, yeah, that's screwed up.
Yeah. Another sequel that they're working on, mercifully, I suppose, is 300 Battle for Artemisia. Artemisia.
Is that going to be based off of the Xerxes comic?
No.
Huh.
Not as far as I know.
Wow.
But 300 Battle for Artemisia is the prequel to Zack Snyder's 2006 blockbuster directed. And this one's going to be directed by Noam Murrow. Is starting to come together with Deadline reporting that Jamie Blackley from London Boulevard will be joining Sullivan Stapleton as the co-lead. Having just wrapped a supporting role in Snow White and the Huntsman and the lead in Andrew Douglas's internet thriller, You Want Me to Kill Him.
There's an internet thriller? That's a real genre?
Yes, apparently. Huh. Blackley will play 16-year-old Callisto, inspired by his soldier father to lead a band of soldiers to war. As far as I understand it, this one is, last I heard, this one deals more with the Themistocles out in the ocean.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, the other half of the actual battle.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. You know, we'll see.
I just assumed it'd be based off of the Xerxes book coming out.
I don't think it's out yet. And I said Frank Miller's insane, so.
He's getting there. He's not as bad as Alan Moore, but he's
no,
insane.
Oh, no, but he will be in his, you know, give him another 10 years.
Yeah, he's got to grow that beard first.
Yes, he's got to grow a beard and be all crazy. Kick-Ass 2 apparently is going to start shooting this summer.
They need to finish that comic then, huh?
Mark Miller said in an interview that with the Scottish Daily Record last weekend that Kick-Ass 2 will shoot this summer. It would fit in the window that Miller identified as necessary to make the film work with the ages of the characters. But little else is known of the sequel except that Matthew Vaughn, who directed the first film, will not direct this one. Although he is expected to direct The Secret Service, another Miller property. Perhaps one reason for secrecy is that the film may be another low-budget, self-funded affair. The cool thing I thought about the first one was Vaughn raised money for the first Kick-Ass film himself, which was made for $30 million and grossed $96 million worldwide and did very well indeed.
Man, I have a hard time coming up with gas money sometimes.
Yeah. Miller also said that a film based on his graphic novel, American Jesus, will also shoot this summer. So. I like Kick-Ass.
It's all right. I like Mark Strong in it.
Oh, yeah. Mark Strong is typically awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I like that movie okay. It was pretty good.
Let's see. I got just two more bits, and the last one I'm leaving for us to punctuate. First off, is rumor has it from a quote source close to the film that we're going to see the first trailer for the Man of Steel on Dark Knight Rises, which would make sense.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so we might see that on when it hits theaters July 20th.
Man, everyone's going to walk out of that theater bitching about everything, huh?
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
Eesh.
Okay, you want to talk Sherlock? You want to talk Elementary?
Let's do it. I don't know anything about it. I haven't seen anything else.
No, we haven't talked about Johnny Lee Miller.
Yes, we have.
Sue Vertue has spoken up about the Johnny Lee Miller's Elementary casting. This time, obviously regarding the news that Johnny Lee Miller...
Oh, Sue Vertue is talking about it.
Yes.
Okay.
Awesome. Sue Vertue is one of the executive producers on Sherlock for the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Miller shared the spotlight with awesomely cheekboned Benedict Cumberbatch and Danny Boyle's critically acclaimed play Frankenstein, where both actors won. That's just the article. Both actors won a Best Actor prize after alternately sharing the same two roles, that of Frankenstein and his monster. Johnny Miller has been cast in the New York based modern Sherlock Holmes from CBS. Vertue told The Independent, quote, "Johnny is a very fine actor who I saw recently in the theater when he and Benedict played alternating roles in Frankenstein. Let's hope their pilot script has stayed further away from our Sherlock than their casting choice," she said. "We have been in touch with CBS and informed them that we will be looking at their finished pilot very closely for any infringement of our rights." CBS replied, quote, "Our project is a contemporary take on Sherlock Holmes that will be based on Holmes, Watson, and other characters in the public domain, as well as original characters. We are, of course, respectful of all copyright laws and will not infringe on any stories or works that may still be protected." Yay.
How? Do I even care? How do they determine that? How do they determine what's copyrighted?
No, well, like basically what the BBC has done, that's copyrighted.
Well, right, they couldn't remake that, but
right.
But like the
they need it to be different enough from that.
But like the Scarlet Lady, that's probably public domain, but they need to like not do. I'm glad I'm not a lawyer or anywhere close to it, but geez, I don't want to see. I want the show to be great. I
think it's supposed to come out this year, isn't it? Like August. Or
I think so,
September?
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, at least a pilot.
Meh. I don't see how it could even live up to.
Well, it's such a good show, but I mean, I'm going to try to give it a fair shake, but
we shall see. It might be.
I hope it's great. I'm not being a smartass. I hope it's great.
I kind of want to see a storm of litigation from CBS and the BBC and see them going at it. It'd be kind of amusing. But that's just me.
CBS probably has some money, though.
That's true. That's true. That's all I got, news-wise.
Judi Dench is going blind. You see that?
I did not see that.
Mm-hmm. She's got macular degeneration, and she is going blind. I mean, I don't really have anything further to add. She's going to continue to work as her health allows, but she announced that the other day.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yep, that is too bad. But hey.
She's a fine actress.
Very fine actress. Academy Award winning knighted actress, no less.
Dame Judi Dench.
Dame Judi Dench. How about call her Sir Judi Dench?
Yeah, Sir Judi Dench.
Sir Judi Dench. I can't say that. Sir Judy. I have nothing else to add. Do you have anything to add, Christopher?
No.
Well, stay tuned. We're going to be right back. We're going to talk about our favorite of the Guilty Pleasures. I don't care. Won't stop from work as it melts and the sun's coming up. I came here to make you dance tonight. I don't care if I'm a guilty pleasure for you. Shut up, cause we won't stop. We're getting melts and the sun's coming up. And we are back. We have Christopher McLaughlin on here, and we decided to kind of go kind of topical, like what we've been doing lately, talking about award-winning movies, best picture winners, favorite performances, etc. But we're going the other way. Yeah, we like talking about these movies that are great and they have their artistic integrity, but when it comes down to us, all of us have those movies that we don't really have our reasons for. We just like to watch. We enjoy them. They're not the best things ever made, but we're able to shut off our criticometer and get moving on.
Yes, and often it's for some reason that we really can't put our finger on. We still like it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think, you know, you said guilty pleasures, and I was like, I'm going to go into the movies that, you know, I know are bad, that most people hate, but I like them just because I don't know why. I just do, you know?
And that's exactly how I kind of made my list. It's like, you know, there's none of these movies that I'm going to particularly, that I will particularly defend the way that they were made, but I'm just going to say I like them, you know, despite all their little flaws, because sometimes, you know, I don't have to be moved. It doesn't have to be an artistic cinema.
Mm-hmm.
It just needs to be a way that keeps my attention for 90 minutes or whatever to have some fun with it.
And I know when I was sort of attacking this list, I really tried to steer clear of my cheesy movies thing, you know.
Yeah.
Because those are guilty pleasures, but, you know, slightly different, you know. So, you know, Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2 doesn't appear on this list,
mm-hmm.
but I do consider those to be, you know, cheese classics.
Sure.
But I think for these movies, they sort of have to be, you know, have a personal investment in it, as far as, you know, you just like it, you know, you just you understand it's bad, but you just love it. And I had a lot of fun coming up with my list of nominees for this list.
Yeah, so. It was a tough one. You had some problems putting this together. You're having to whittle it down, weren't you, Christopher?
I was, but it was honestly due to some outside considerations. I'm back in my insomnia 4 hours of sleep cycle, so it's just a question of finding enough conscious hours to actually sit down and put them in an order.
Gotcha.
But
go ahead.
I was done.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. This sounded like there's more to it. But no, I mean, yeah. When it comes down to it, these are all. Let me look at my list real quick. Yeah, there's not one of these that I'm going to argue is a good movie. Not one of them on my list.
Well, what is a guilty pleasure movie to you, Aaron? I mean,
what
was your criteria?
My criteria is and that's exactly it. Mine is one that you're not going to catch me arguing with you that it's a good movie.
Sure.
It's just a movie that I enjoy, you know, for like whatever reason. Sometimes, sometimes they have that nostalgic shine to them. Sometimes they'll just be, you know, yeah, I get it. This is certainly not supposed to be Lawrence of Arabia, but it's still kind of fun, and I don't know. It's kind of hard to pin down like movies that I don't tear apart, you know, at every single seam.
Yeah.
That, you know, where there's definitely movies that are just as bad as any one of these that I've destroyed. But, you know, for whatever reason, these ones that hold up to a little bit of.
But these movies have something about them that just sort of, you know, gives them a shine that you like. You know?
Exactly.
What about you, Christopher? How did you tackle this?
Very similar fashion. I had the two criteria of, first of all, it had to be a film that the critics hated and the vast majority of people who saw them hated them for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, I can find at least some defensible something in it that keeps me drawing me back to these films again and again and again and again. And I watch them. Despite the fact that, you know, I'm a fish swimming upstream as far as critical opinion is concerned.
Mm-hmm. I think there's probably only one movie on my list that I would actually be a bit more stand up about defending as far as whether it's a bad or a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the movies on my list are all, yeah, they're bad. But you know what? Screw you guys. I like it. And
exactly.
I like it for various reasons.
Exactly.
Because, you know, ultimately, you know, when I go see a movie, when I go see any movie, really, I do go with a certain expectation, but I don't go and watch War Horse with the same way I go and watch Transformers 3. You
right.
Know? You can't go to movies like that. You cannot do it. It's ridiculous. But if you go to see a movie like Transformers 3 expecting something like War Horse or Saving Private Ryan, you're going to be a bit disappointed.
And I think that's a big problem with a lot of modern movie audiences.
I think that's a problem with a lot of modern movie critics.
Yeah, that too. Well, audiences and critics.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's an issue with modern people.
Mm-hmm.
They expect everything to be Casablanca and Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
They don't understand that of the AFI top 100, there's probably 300,000 movies.
And
on
I don't
there.
Think it's fair to analyze movies along the same lines as everything.
No.
So I mean, yes, I enjoy a movie like like the remake of Death Race. It's not on this list because I consider that heavily cheesy, and enough people like that too. But by no means do I say, well, it's better than The Artist. I mean, I enjoy both movies, but in different ways.
Exactly. I mean, you don't want to, and you nailed it. I mean, you do have to look at what a movie is trying to be in terms of.
Well, because, you know, you know very well that, you know, when the filmmakers set out to make The Artist, they were aiming for something. They were aiming for what they got. And when someone sets out to make Transformers 3, they're not aiming for that.
Right, they're aiming for something entirely
different.
They're
aiming for some entertainment, and sometimes you just want to go see a movie and you just want to be entertained. You don't want to have to think about this existential, you know, quandaries of the universe. Mm-hmm. You just
I think Transformers 3 pushes the boundaries of their trying to entertain us. I think that they've just discovered that they can put any old crap with giant robots on it and people will pay $10 to see it.
Damn straight.
They're just
so phenomenally phenomenally lazily done. I don't think anybody cares about anything other than your dollars.
For me, it's what I expected out of a Transformers sequel. You know, they make money doing this. They're not going to change that formula.
Yeah, I've only seen the first one.
It's what I expected out of a third movie about giant robots beating the crap out of each other.
Yeah.
That was originally made to sell toys.
And that's my whole thing about it. Is I saw the first one, I didn't like it, and so I'm not one of those people yelling and screaming about 2 and 3 because I didn't see them. I don't care.
There's enough movies out there that are made. I mean, thousands of movies are made potentially each year.
Yeah.
And I can easily tell you right now that, you know, a movie like Doom, for crying out loud, if you want to sit here and pick apart a movie based on the first person shooter video game, go right ahead.
You'd be the first person.
But
certainly no one who made it gave it any sort of critical thought.
Nope.
Exactly. It is what it is. You know, it's like what I remember talking to people who really picked that movie apart, and I'm like, seriously? This is a movie based on a first-person shooter video game. What were you expecting? Freaking, you know, Shakespeare?
Yeah.
So I think for me, it all goes into expectations of the movie.
And that's what it's going to have to come down to, because, I don't know, a lot of these kind of have a nostalgic shine to them, because a lot of them are ones I saw as a kid.
Oh, yeah, definitely for me. A lot of the ones I'm looking at are late 80s, early 90s, actually.
Sure.
So,
well.
Or a lot of them are ones from my childhood.
Yeah.
Ones that I saw when I was
young. Yeah, you know, you grew up watching me, you liked him, and it wasn't until you got older, you were like, okay, that sucked, but I don't care. I liked it.
One on my list that is in the last, was made in the last decade, and it's not even my top six. So, actually, no, I'm sorry, I had two made in the last decade, and then neither of them are in my top six.
Two. I have two in the last, or three in the last decade.
So. But a lot of these are movies I would sort of classify as, you know, movies that I like this. I don't care if you don't like it or not. Bite me. I like it.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
And really, it's like, I'm not going to sit here and have an argument with, sit here and argue with someone over, why do I like this movie? I just do.
Yeah.
And a lot of it
so
is just that.
Can we just assume that whatever we pick, the other two are going to hate it?
Oh, yeah, probably.
I've been thinking about that, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of times where I'm all like, I like that movie. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, because I could see.
Or you nothing that movie.
Yeah,
you know?
Or like, I forgot about that. Oh, yeah, that was on in the background when I was smoking pot when I was 12 or whatever.
Well,
yeah.
a lot of it, and we talked about this earlier, a lot of it is subjective.
Yeah, it is. Know? It's absolutely.
A lot of these are ones I like. You know, probably because
film criticism subjective.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously. But what I'm saying is, a lot of these are I like them because of personal experience or because of childhood. It's like, oh, it's that nostalgic thing. So.
Absolutely. Well, let's get started on this. What's your number six, Ethan?
Okay, my number six is a real dog that I recently found on clearance DVD for $2, and was like, oh, that's worth $2 to me. And it's one of those I go back and watch and go, man, did that really come out 21 years ago? And it's the 1990 directed by Stuart Gordon, Robot Jocks.
Never even heard of it.
With Scott Glenn.
Never even heard of it.
Oh, it's about giant robots. Basically, it's Rollerball with giant robots.
Neat.
And instead of the Rollerball thing, they have giant robots fight each other, and they're the kind of.
You have a soft spot or a blind spot in your critical thingy when it comes to robots, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, and the effects in this are terrible.
Yeah.
But I remember when this came out, when I saw it, I think I spotted it on video, when it hit video, or I may have seen a trailer for it. But it really. This came out when I was, you know, 10 years old, so I'm like going, okay, I'm just getting into gaming, and, you know, hey, there's this cool thing called Battletech, and this movie comes out, I'm like, sweet, giant robots kicking the crap out of each other.
I certainly remember the days of that's the way I found out about movies was I saw the video box on the store shelf.
Well, and with this movie is with Robot Jocks, I had forgotten all about it until I spotted it on a clearance rack at Half Price Bookstore. It was
right
like,
on.
Oh, sweet. And I took it home and watched it and was like, wow, this is so bad. I love it. You know, it's the same sort of thing that why I like Knight Rider still. You know, it's like, oh, it's so bad, but I love it. It's so wonderful. And Robot Jocks is it's Scott Glenn.
I like Scott Glenn. Definitely.
And it's directed by Stuart Gordon, the guy who did Reanimator.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
So I mean, this horror director comes in, and this is really a rollerball knockoff type of movie.
Yeah.
And of course, it was a huge box office bomb. And
it's always fun it's always fun to revisit movies like that mm-hmm. you haven't seen in forever.
Oh, God, I don't think I'd seen this in 15, 20 years.
And then you look at it and you're like, holy crap! Like I watched that fucking movie with the bear. And Anthony Hopkins, The Edge.
Yeah, The Edge.
I watched that like a week or two ago, like right after I saw The Gray.
Mm-hmm.
And that was written by that snobby writer guy. The guy that always has in his contracts, you cannot change a word. God damn it, what is his name? Shit. I mean, it blew my mind that it was written by this guy. Because he's like,
there's going to be some edits here.
Yeah, it was directed by Lee Tamahori, the guy that directed.
Oh, right.
And it was. He did
one of the Bond movies, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He did that. He did some other stuff. But it was
David Mamet.
David Mamet wrote that movie. And, you know, he's like that. He's, you know, your atypical stuck up, you know, hoity-toity. And I don't know. I'm probably going to cut all this out because that's my whole point is it's always weird to go back to movies that you saw 15 years ago and you realize, holy crap, that's done by people of noteworthy. But yeah, that's nuts. Absolutely nuts.
Hmm. Alrighty. Well,
have you seen or heard of this one, Christopher?
You know, we saw that at 3 in the morning on USA all night.
Yeah.
I just remember, all night.
It is definitely one of the movies that would have been shown USA up all night.
And I remember going in with that level of expectations and just coming away furious at how really awful it was, even with those level of expectations. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, this has been 20 years ago. I can't put a finger on why we reacted that viscerally to it, but I just remember just being physically angry at how bad that movie was. I can't tell you why, but that's my memory of it.
Oh, yeah, it's bad, but I still love it.
I have never even heard of it, so I can't add in at all.
And it's Jocks with an X.
Oh, of course
so
it
it's
is.
Edgy.
Yeah, it's got that edge. Christopher, what's your number six?
All righty. Well, my number six here you go. It's kind of all in the title, but it's the classic AIP drive-in horror classic, The Incredible Melting Man.
I like that movie. I can see why you would choose that.
All righty. Well, now, okay, first of all, let's go ahead and lay our cards on the table. The film was justifiably skewered on Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's one of their absolute best episodes in my book. And, I mean, really, what more could you say about it being a terrible film? But here's where I find value in it.
William Sachs, that's right.
William Sachs, I heard him on a commentary track discussing his career. And he confirmed something that I'd always suspected about the film, is that he shot a comedy that the studio re-edited to make it more horrific. And it failed utterly, because it just careens back and forth between the comedy that Sachs wanted to make and tried to make, and them trying to get a scary drive-in movie out of it. So just the tonal shifts alone are gonna make it, you know, sort of meta-hilarious in that MST fashion. But the humorous touches that Sachs is intending, if you go in expecting that and knowing to look for it, it becomes a completely different, much more enjoyable movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as much as the shocks in that film don't work in that context, let's give some credit to multi-Academy Award-winning Rick Baker for designing a genuinely disconcerting and creepy monster.
I met him. He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, and I mean, and I'm generally not a fan of remakes, and I'm not really sure how many studios are going to open the door for me, you know, telling them I've got a reboot of The Incredible Melting Man all typed up, you know. But the notion of a melting people that only, you know, maintain their body integrity by eating other people, you know, that's a fairly creepy concept to start off with. So I think, you know, I mean to me the horror works thanks to Baker's skill, and the comedy is there on a couple of different levels. So again, you know, it's not going to be on the AFI 100 anytime soon, but you know, I think there's more of a movie there than the title and the fact that it was mistied would lead you to believe.
Well, I'm looking at it on IMDb right now, and it's actually on their bottom 100. And I actually think it's funny. I'm up on their page right now, and they have their poster, and the poster that they have is a scanned image of. It looks like a handbill because it's all like folded up and crap. And it's just funny, they don't even have like a good high resolution scan to throw up on IMDb. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, I saw this, and I think I did see it on an MST3K DVD.
That doesn't surprise me.
I'm almost positive. I could be wrong, but it was something else. But I kind of like movies like that. I kind of like movies like that. But have you seen it, Ethan? Heard of it?
I've heard of it, but never seen it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. For my number six, I'm just going to go with one that I imagine that people, I don't know, but it's Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Because one of the things that always will get a goat out of me to where I just hate the crap out of something is something that is so hyperly focusedly made for A, either one group of people, or B, for one group of people from a specific amount of time. Like, I hate topical comedy. I cannot stand it. Like, I don't like South Park. And I don't like those stupid farce movies, like Epic Movie, like what was the Meet the Spartans? Like, mm-hmm. I hate stuff like that because they're so topical that yeah. I saw this movie like a year or two after it came out, like on DVD or something, and I didn't get any of the goddamn jokes because it was all like flash in the pan pop culture moments.
Well, all the scary movie and all
yeah, and it was just I hate it. And my problem with something why I should not like Scott Pilgrim is because it's such a movie that's made for me. Nobody else is going to see this movie and really care. And when I say me, I mean a 30, 35, 40-year-old geek, ex-geek, grew up on the 8-bit Nintendo generation kind of thing, ADD poster child. But at the same time, I am in that group. So I do enjoy it. And I've often spoke about how I would say the movie that makes it into my DVD player the most often is No Country for Old Men. Mm. But I would say the movie that makes it into my DVD player the second most often is Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Because I just think it's made with a passion, and it's kind of like a love letter to this stuff that I grew up loving. It doesn't necessarily mean it needed to be made. I can see every single bit of criticism about it, but I still enjoy it, and I'm glad it's out there. So I picked it for number six.
Cool. Cool.
You... not seen it, Christopher?
I caught it on Netflix. We have the streaming service here ourselves, and it just sort of concerned. Again, you know, we've already gotten out of the way how personal these lists are.
Uh-huh.
It just sort of confirmed something that I've felt for a long time now, and you know, not since Bruce Willis have I encountered a celebrity I want to punch in the face more than Michael Cera.
And I'm right there with you, dude.
Uh huh.
I probably more so than you. But and I want to punch him in that movie.
And I understood that they were taking a much beloved, wonderfully quirky comic series, but I'm just like, you know, there's not enough charm and quirk here to make me want to be staring at Michael Cera for longer than 5 minutes, especially since I'm supposed to be rooting for him.
Yeah.
And that's one of my main concerns with the movies, because you know, and Ethan will tell you, I hate Michael Cera. Mm-hmm. I want to remove.
I probably would have liked this movie better if Michael Cera wasn't.
And I probably would have too. So. But the thing is, I like.
But I don't know who else I'd put in that movie.
I like Edgar Wright way more than I dislike Michael Cera. And so so I wanted to see the movie, and I also, you know,
I thought it was well directed.
It was really well directed, and it's such an obnoxious movie too. Mm-hmm. But I still like it, and I completely agree with the Michael Cera stuff. But to me,
I haven't seen it since theaters.
Yeah, I've probably seen it 5 times because it's just such a weird movie. Mm-hmm. Probably 10 times. Hell, I don't know, but I don't know, and I can't.
I tell you the analogy I can make here. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, it's like watching Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory if they'd gotten some asshole to be Willy Wonka.
There you go.
Gene Wilder.
There you go.
I mean, good Lord, how many of that film's flaws would be right there magnified in your face, you know, if you didn't have Wilder's performance holding it all together.
I love Gene Wilder.
You know,
well, I mean,
as you
I
should.
So want that movie on Blu-ray, really but it's only available in that set, in that $75 set.
Ooh.
Not true. I got. Well, I mean, I got it. It may be out of print now, but I got it in a digibook for $20.
Yeah, that version is out of print.
Oh, those bastards.
Yeah, it's only available in this big anniversary edition.
And that's a real good analogy, Christopher. And
thank you.
I think that. And I think that I would not feel, and I almost struggled putting this on here because of the fact that I for the most part, I don't think it's a particularly bad movie. But it's so like laser focused on this obnoxious person that I am, and then the main character is, you know, I mean, it kind of like, you know, takes all of my insecurities about myself and puts it on Front Street, and I see those things in myself, and then it's Michael Cera portraying him, and it just kind of pisses me off about myself. But I do like a lot of stuff about it, and I don't know. See, and that's just it. It's a guilty pleasure. So that's why I picked it. Why I picked it.
And you remember when I was when we were first talking up these lists, I mentioned one that I would probably defend.
Mm-hmm.
I just replaced it with one. So
okay, you're not going to be defending it.
So no, I won't be needing to defend that one. my number five is a movie I have very fond memories of watching with my dad, and it is the 1959 Pietro Francischi film Hercules Unchained. With Steve Reeves.
I almost thought you were going to say Hercules in New York.
Oh God, no! I'm not. I don't have that much brain damage. This movie is bad. I mean, this movie was on MST3K.
Was it?
Oh yeah, they MST3K'd it. But it when they did that, I was like, I don't want to watch it because I don't want to watch the MST3K version just because I have such fond memories of it with my dad. Because I mean. You know, with us, we have Steve Reeves, a Superman, you know, but you know, my dad's hero when he was a kid growing up was Steve Reeves, and so you know, my dad and I got a chance to share in that with watching Hercules and Hercules Unchained,
mm-hmm.
And you know, Steve Reeves only did these two Hercules movies,
yeah,
and you know, me being a fan of Greek mythology and whatnot, I mean, these horribly butcher the mythology,
sure.
Obviously. But they're still entertaining, and especially as a kid to watch. You know, you're like going, oh, okay, yeah, you know, Hercules running around, you know, beating the crap out of people in 1959 fashion. And this, of course, being a spaghetti movie,
mm-hmm.
Is it's prior to the spaghetti westerns, obviously.
Oh yeah.
It's interesting to sort of look at some of the history because Steve Reeves was offered the role in. The Fistful of Dollars.
Oh yeah,
but turned it down because he didn't think that an Italian director could make a good Western.
That's like
the guy that didn't buy the Apple stock because he didn't see people wanting computers in their house.
Yes.
You know? Like, oh.
And like in the spaghetti westerns, Steve Reeves is an American actor and he's speaking English through the whole movie. Everyone else is dubbed. And looking back at it now, I can't imagine how difficult that must have been to do this, to be in this movie, because everyone else is speaking Italian. You know, it's the bad dubbing, and it's real bad dubbing. I mean, it's awful dubbing. And even, I think even Chris Reeve is, Steve Reeves is dubbed in it. You know, our sort of our generation's Arnold Schwarzenegger, the previous generation was Steve Reeves.
Oh yeah,
he was an amazing guy.
When did
he
die? 99, 2000, around there?
Sometime around there, yes. I remember the year he died, I bought a autographed picture of him at Gen Con for my dad.
Oh wow.
And it was still early enough that it hadn't, you know, they hadn't decided to quadruple the price or anything like
that's good.
So, as far as I know, my dad still has that. And it's just one of those real special movies to me,
and
you know, you can find copies of it for a penny, and it's all, I mean, it's bad.
And it's not worth it.
It is bad, but it's a guilty pleasure for me.
Oh, absolutely.
It's very much something that goes into this category for me. So, yeah, Steve Reeves, you know, we have Chris Reeves as Superman, Steve Reeves, since I watched these movies when I was a kid, when I think Hercules, this is sort of the image I get is Steve Reeves with two chains, you know, pulling two pillars down, and that's about it. So I enjoy it. It's Hercules Unchained. What more can I say?
Sounds like a good little personal choice for you. That's good. That's real good. Christopher, number five.
All righty. Well, my number five is the 70s non-classic Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Okay.
Go ahead. Let's get
Is that the one with Ricardo Montalban?
No.
Or is that Beneath the Planet of the Apes?
The third and the fourth one.
Okay.
This is the fifth one.
It's the Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
I can't comment because I've only seen the original Planet of the Apes.
That's the Ape Shall Never Kill Ape one, right? When he knocks him out of the tree?
Yes.
I love that. I mean, I don't love that movie, but boy, is it. I actually don't like.
I would anticipate it's better than the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes movie.
Yeah.
Well, let's face it, walking into the monkey cage at the zoo and having poo flung at you is better than the Tim Burton
and
reimagining.
Be fair, the only Planet of the Apes movie that I even remotely like is the original.
Yeah.
I didn't like the Burton one, and I did not like this new one. And everyone tells me I should have, but I didn't. And I'm sorry. Yeah. But I did
You know my position on it was fine until the whole Apes Rising bit.
Yeah, and I don't even agree with you there.
And then at that point, you know, it's like, okay, it's the whole impetus, the whole reason for the movie, it's bad and stupid.
So. I don't know. For me, it felt like, okay, that almost looks like an ape. And that was that was me. And but I do remember that Ape Shall Never Kill Ape chant at the end of that movie, and it always cracked me up. I'm sorry, but continue.
All righty. Well, now, okay. As I did last time, we will have to concede the bad parts of this film.
Yes.
Okay. It does something that makes me despise far more worthier films in that it's a second draft script replacing an infinitely superior first draft. I've never been able to look at this movie the same way since I read Paul Dean's original conception of this movie, which would have been brilliant if they could have carried it off to any degree. So it's a much, much, much compromised, inferior version of what was originally intended. Normally that bugs me to no end. That's what soured me on Monty Python and the Holy Grail to Day of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
I've just never been able to look at them the same after seeing what was originally intended. So yes, we have to concede that this is a horribly compromised version. It's a kids' movie,
yep.
And normally nothing gets me running to the exit faster than kids' movie. Okay, you know, you've sort of downgraded from Academy Award winner Charlton Heston to Paul Williams and Claude Akins,
mm-hmm.
you know, as Carrie in your movie. You know, John Huston shows up en route to a poker game for, you know, I mean, but, you know, we've definitely downgraded on the quality of the acting. Their budget, I think, was roughly $4.37. You know, it's cheap even by 70s sci-fi standards. But here is what I adore about this movie. Number one, it has heart. And normally, I'm sort of immune to that sort of thing. But the fact that they take that heart and they couple it with ideas, there are ideas floating around in this quickie cash-in kids movie. And where else do you get that in a kid's movie? That's relatively rare, especially since most kid movies these days are, we'll slap a few CGI talking animals on there, and the kids will go see it. We're throwing a couple of fart jokes, and we're good. We got it covered. But, you know, there are all these little bits in there that are they aren't carried off well.
Yeah, sure.
There's not enough talent, frankly, behind this film. But notions of, like, you know, the fact that they tried it, that this is the one that finally establishes the series is circular. You know,
yep.
Can you avoid your future? Is there any avoiding fate? You know, something as silly as the conscience of the arsenal. You know, I mean, it's hilariously ill conceived and ill executed. But you know, it's an idea. It's trying to make you think about something in its sad little pathetic way. You know. And so, you know, the fact that it's got, I think, a great mix of heart and ideas that you just don't see in many movies, especially quickie cash and sequels to kids' movies, that to me makes it a cut above more than what it should be. And, of course, I have to talk about the movie's greatest strength. Roddy McDowall, I have seen Roddy McDowall in far, far worse films, one of which just barely missed the cut for my list, in fact.
Okay.
The man was to me, the man is one of the most underrated actors ever. Man had a great knack for picking very, 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 very bad films, and this is one of them. But you know, the genuine capacity he had for elevating material like this, I think, just it makes it for me at even at the very worst a watchable film.
Oh yeah.
You know, even though you're probably glad when his obnoxious son dies. You know, when Roddy is on there, he at least sells the loss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, it's a little movie with enough heart and charm to carry it onto my list.
Yeah, and you know, like, and since these are all guilty pleasures, you know, there I don't really feel any need to say you're wrong or anything like that. My whole thing about the Planet of the Apes movies is, as far as I was concerned, for me, and this could very much be my deficiency. But as far as I am concerned, for me seeing them, I really had no interest after the cat was let out of the bag at the end of the first one. I mean, yeah, they did some interesting stuff with it, but ultimately that was the big thing. I mean, it would almost be like, you know, you watch The Sixth Sense and then you watch movies about Ghost Bruce Willis. And you know what I mean? While there could be some fun stuff done with that, ultimately it just kind of got away from the original punch of the original movie. And you know, and I also don't really care about monkey movies except for King Kong.
I will happily concede the second movie just blows and blows and blows some more. But the third one is such a great reversal of the themes.
Is
the
that Conquest?
That's Escape.
Okay.
You know, the
and we're talking Beneath right now.
Beneath is the second one. That's the one. Okay. That is.
This is Battle for Planet of the Apes. Okay.
Battle is the one that's on my list.
Okay.
The third one, Escape, is a great echo of the first one. It's a great companion piece. And the fourth one, I think, is severely underrated, especially if you see the restored original director's cut that's on the Blu-ray set. It is a much, much more powerful, intense, and higher quality movie before the studio re-edited after the test audience is free. It's a genuinely disturbing, dark sci-fi film that I think if anybody's paying attention to this, I think it's a film that the appreciation of it is going to increase as more people discover this new, much, much better, genuine version of it.
I'm not going to say I've seen it. I'm not going to say I haven't seen it. I'm pretty sure I've seen all of these, but they didn't really stick in my memory. But
I know I've only seen the original films. I've only seen the first one. So
yeah, I've definitely seen Battle for the Planet of the Apes because I do remember that last scene where he knocks him out of a tree, right? And it's he kills an ape and then they chase him up into a tree and then they knock him out, right? Yeah, yes. Yeah. Ape shall never kill ape. Ape shall never. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I certainly remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the only thing I can add really is the first movie. My dad has a great story about the first movie. My dad used to. Going to school at Brigham Young University, and they showed Planet of the Apes at their student theater there, and the administration made him cut the ending.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Cut the ending where they find the Statue of Liberty, and you know, talk about just destroying the whole point of the movie. You know,
imagine them doing that at Brigham Young.
You know. Yeah,
why am I reminded of that episode of Friends where one of the characters, their parents never showed her the actual end of Old Yeller?
Yeah, yeah.
And she can't figure out why everybody else is so depressed by that movie.
Yeah, that was funny, yeah. Yeah, that was good stuff.
Okay. Well, Aaron, what's your number five?
Well, my number five should have been my number six because it's one that I've only seen. Well, I bet you I've seen it quite a few times, but I only discovered it within the last couple of years. And I don't remember what year it is. I don't remember who directed it. But it's Troll 2.
Yeah, Troll 2.
I've
never seen it.
It is not a good movie. Not by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not going to say that. But for some reason...
Troll 2. 1990 seems to be a magic year. So it's the 1990...
I'm surprised it's that.
Claudio Fragrasso.
There you go. But I can't... I don't want to use the train wreck scenario. Because, I don't know, I watched that movie... And, you know, I don't care about the story. The story's dumb. But I almost like to watch it for those punctuations that you're just like, what the hell? You know, like that internet meme, like, oh, my God, they're going to kill me. And then they're going to kill me. Oh, my God. I mean, like, it's just like, why would you make that decision? I'm not an actor, and I know I would never deliver a line like that. All right? It's like, oh, my God, they're eating her. And then they're going to eat me. Oh, my God. It's just mind-boggling. Like the last scene when they're eating his mom, like, hey, do you want some, Jimmy? And it's just, there's just so many. Or the whole thing with what's that line? You don't piss on hospitality, Jimmy. Or like, it's, there's just so many weird ass moments in that movie. It's just fascinating to watch.
I kind of enjoy watching it, but I don't know why.
Now, just so I have this completely straight in my mind, this is the film where they have the making of documentary that is actually titled Worst Movie Ever Made.
Yeah, Best Worst Movie.
Yeah,
yes.
Best Worst Movie.
Yes, that's it.
Yes,
that's it.
It's on Netflix. Okay. I've watched it. I've watched that. I haven't watched Axel the Troll 2.
It's just fascinatingly bad. Uh-huh. And it's not one of those ones that like works in spite of itself. No. No, the bad stuff is just interesting, you know? I can't put my finger on, but I swear to God, Rachel and I watched that movie, the best worst movie.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm like, oh, I might as well watch this. And then I watched it, and Rachel's like, what the hell? And he's like, okay, whatever, I'm going to bed. Then I watched it again. And then I think I watched it again like a week later, and I watched it a week after that. Because it's just fascinatingly awfully made. But I still kind of like watching it, and I'm not going to defend it. It's just like, huh, how about that? So it's my number five.
Or five. Yep, that's your number five.
What's your number four, Ethan?
My number four, guilty pleasure of all guilty pleasures, in my opinion, the quintessential Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. It's the 1985 Commando.
That's not a bad movie.
Directed by Mark Lester, written a story by Jeff Loeb himself, you know.
Really?
Yes.
Yes.
Wow, you know, I have the director's cut of this movie on DVD.
Mm.
Yes, that it's one of those that, yes, there is a director's cut of this movie. You know, you expect to see it go out, hey, director's cut of Blade Runner. Yeah, I can see this. But no, they decided to put out a director's cut of Commando. And yes, on DVD,
it
and I own it. Oh, yes, it adds footage.
Oh, wow.
Of all the director's cuts I've seen, it is one of them.
Yeah, like when you asked me what the director's cut added of what the director's cut of Green Lantern added to it, I said 20 minutes.
Yeah, you're like, I think this was like 4 minutes.
And it, you know, there's no real content; it's just 20 minutes.
And I've seen the original. The sort of putting the cherry on this is the version of this movie I grew up watching was edited for TV.
Oh, sure.
So it's even better, you know. And I finally
we could do a show on favorite edited for TV movies.
Oh, yes, we could.
Die Hard with a Vengeance is so great edited for TV.
RoboCop.
One time I called him something worse.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Have you seen the edited Big Lebowski?
Yep. That's a good one. That's on the Blu-ray, isn't it?
It should be.
I'm pretty sure it's on the Blu-ray, like the fancy Blu-ray. It's hilarious.
Well, Commando is pretty much what you expect out of an Arnold Schwarzenegger. When someone says it's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, this is the movie that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. It has the obligatory, you know, paper thin fucking plot. He is, of course, a Superman.
Is this pre or post Predator?
This is pre Predator. This was 85.
Yeah. And did Predator turn in, or did a?
I think Predator was 87.
Okay.
I wanna say.
What I'm asking is, I thought I remember hearing that Predator was originally a Commando 2 sequel that just turned into Predator. Or vice versa, or something like that happened.
Yeah. But you know, Commando 2, it's got the great one-liners in
it. Get to the choppa.
No, that's Predator. Oh, Commando's got the let off some steam in it. You know, it is so bad, and it is everything that you would say is a cliche from an 80s action movie is in this, and you have, of course, the first blood type of colonel or general or whoever the hell
army
the army guy,
obligatory army man, G.I. Joe,
who is trying to get Arnold, whose name is John Matrix in the movie.
Yeah.
Right out loud. And his daughter is played by a very young Alyssa Milano.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about the villain was Dan Hedaya.
Can I jump in for just a second?
Sure.
Bringing up Alyssa Milano and Dan Hedaya, it reminds me of why I think this is actually one of Arnold's better films. Is it's got a pretty amazing supporting cast.
Yeah.
You sit down and take stock of those two.
Not to forget Milano, seven. In that movie was made.
Not to forget Ray Don Chong. You know,
Ray Don Chong, Daniel Patrick Kelly from the Warriors, Bill Duke. Vernon Wells.
I am almost positive I have not seen this movie.
Yep. Yep. And it is, you know,
Bill
is,
Paxton.
It is such one of those. I don't think Bill Paxton is in this. Well, no, yes, he is. He's one of the naval guys at the radar station. Yes, I remember that now. It is just such a beautifully messed up movie, because I remember watching this movie, and even as a kid, I was spotting continuity errors.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite one is after he kills Sully, who was David Patrick Kelly. Patrick Kelly's character is like, and I always go back, that scene is just so funny. You promised to kill me this. That's right, I did. I lied and dropped, and that scene is hysterical. Right before that, the guy's Porsche has been they flipped over on its side and skidded, and so he flips it down, and the side is all screwed up, and he gets in the car and they drive off, and the camera shows them drive off, and it in the car you see the passenger side, and then it turns a corner and goes to the driver's side, and it's fine. Literally no damage whatsoever.
Nice.
And then of course the next scene, they're arriving at this hotel, the side's damaged again.
Nice.
And I noticed this thing when I was a kid, and it is just, like I keep saying, you know, when you say it's the quintessential Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, this has everything in it that you need to say. Okay, you want to know what Arnold Schwarzenegger movies were like in the 1980s? Okay, are what we consider the genre of Arnold Schwarzenegger movie? This is sort of the denouement for me. This is the penultimate.
I'm almost positive I've never seen this movie.
It is just... it's one of those movies that a cleaned up, restored version, which is the director's cut and all that, it makes it even funnier, because there's a great scene in a work shed where he throws one of those saw blades at a guy. You can see the string.
Awesome.
And the last scene where he's killing all of the bad guys, they only had like 3 or 4 stuntmen, and one of them has this awful Burt Reynolds mustache, this handlebar mustache, and it's so obviously fake. And they're just obviously white guys that have been painted up to look like they're Latino.
Wow.
And he throws this saw blade at him. You can see the wire that it's on. You can see the string that is attached to the guy's wig that he's wearing. And you can see, if you're watching it frame by frame, you see it as the blade gets about 3 inches from his head, they pull off the top of his headpiece to show the damage underneath as he gets hit by it.
Awesome.
And I just want to put that scene on loop, because it is just, every time, it just makes me laugh my ass off. It is so funny. And I haven't seen the Blu-ray of it. I assume the Blu-ray is probably, I mean, you could see the squibs. And I mean... It's
single
just
particles
such
of makeup.
A beautifully bad movie, because, you know, they have 3 buildings on this island, and so he blows them up, and they show the explosion from like 12 different angles, like consecutively. It's just amazing. It's an amazingly awful, wonderful movie. So
I'll watch it.
It easily made it onto my list at number 4.
Cool.
Well, let's give it a little bit of credit. Okay, the building blowing up from 12 different angles is saved as a climax for movie. That's not the entire film like it would be today.
Yes, true. And it's also the first time I ever remember seeing a rocket launcher that had 4 rockets in it.
Sweet.
One of those
big, yes, one of those big ones.
2x2, yeah.
And, I mean, it's got the, you know, about some games you have prep scenes, and this has the prep scene where he's loading up, he's putting on the awful camouflage that just wouldn't work anywhere on Earth.
And you're a fan of the your Transformers, mm-hmm. and your Expendables and shit like that, because mm-hmm. you grew up watching stuff like this.
And this movie just...
And I didn't. So yeah. I haven't seen it. I'm pretty sure I haven't seen it.
And this movie is just totally unapologetic about what it is. And it really sort of... It harkens back to a time when you could have characters that weren't this deep and intellectual, oh, I hate doing what I do. It's like, no... I have to get my rifle from the shed,
yeah.
And the code is 1 and 3. It's brilliant in how bad and wonderful it is.
Is there an Arnold Schwarzenegger commentary track?
No,
but since it's so bad, it's like, wow, that's a shot.
There is a director's commentary track on it, but it's not Arnold, because obviously they could. Well, there's a making of.
Mm-hmm.
Arnold's the only one they don't talk to, because obviously they couldn't afford him.
Yeah.
But it's like Ray Don Chong. Everyone else in the movie is in the making of. The making of is actually really fun to watch.
Tyler told me, like, you know, this was years ago when he first moved out there, that he one time saw his spec sheet
mm-hmm.
that goes out for him to be involved in DVDs, and he charged $100,000 to do special features on a DVD.
Wow.
See, man, has kids to feed.
I can honestly see that why they didn't shell out $100. I'm sure they spent maybe $12 getting this DVD out the door. So.
Yeah, most of the time people just offer their services.
Yeah,
you know.
So yes, Commando, 1985, directed by Mark Lester. It is a gem of bad movie.
It's the cubic zirconia of bad movies.
But it's so wonderful, you know.
Excellent. Christopher, what's your number four?
Well, you know, they're going to think we planned this out ahead of time because he just does one of the films that helped solidify and usher in the 80s action film. And to me, I have the film that gave it its send-off. This was the film that sort of capped off the 80s and the action films that had gone before it. And it is, of course, 1989's very own Roadhouse.
Roadhouse.
I love
Patrick Swayze. And
Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
No. Liam Neeson was not in that. He was in Next of Kin.
Could have made it more awesome.
That's true. I like
Roadhouse, not though. But you know, go ahead. I'm sorry. That's a good one.
Well, okay. Now let's be clear here. This is not just a bad film.
Oh yeah.
This is a classic bad film in the spirit of Zardoz, in that it's one man's insanity being given several million dollars to put up on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many elements to this film, and they just get increasingly more bizarre.
Who's the wrestler that's in it? Terry Funk. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Terry Funk is in there. Yes.
I remember.
Wasn't
that.
Jeff Healey in that?
Jeff Healey is in that. He plays the head of the house band.
Thought so.
Mm-hmm. He's not just an ex-soldier. He's a bouncer. Oh, excuse me. He's the cooler.
Yes.
I mean, he's got a degree in philosophy.
Forgot. And he lives in a barn.
Yeah, he lives in a barn. They bring in this weird element with Marshall Teague's character, where he's obviously has a huge crush on Patrick Swayze's character,
mm-hmm.
and reacts like a jealous lover through the whole film. You have Ben Gazzara having the time of his life, knowing he's in the crappiest thing ever made, and he's just cashing a check. But man, he's going to have a great time all the way to the bank.
Sometimes that just makes a great movie.
This isn't
way,
one of those
know?
Movies that I have. Go ahead. Sorry.
You have a female lead visibly embarrassed to be in the film. I got the special edition DVD. They interviewed her 20 years after the fact. She's still humiliated by her association with this film. You have Sam Elliott basically being paid to show up, drink beer, and be Sam Elliott for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just so many disparate elements, and Lord knows they don't come together in any meaningful way. They just happen to be in the same movie.
What's his name? What's Patrick's? Is it Dalton?
Dalton. Yes.
Yeah, they have a Dalton Facts website, kind of like Chuck Norris Facts.
As they should.
It's pretty much the same thing, but yeah.
And it's such a bizarrely quotable film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, goodness me, Pain Don't Hurt.
Pain Don't Hurt.
And the one is, it's one of the lesser known quotes, but ones that I gravitate to. Terry Funk comes up to Dalton just as he's arrived at the Double Deuce and gives him this big, "You don't look like much to me," that you think is going to lead to a fight, and just gives him this really rough dressing down. And Swayze just goes, and goes, "Opinions vary," and walks off. Yay. I've made up my mind that if I ever get in a physical confrontation again, I'm just going to look at the guy and go, "Opinions vary," and walk off and hope I don't get my ass kicked as I'm turning around.
This is a movie that's really grown in its mockability. Mm. I mean, this is a movie that, like, you said it was 89, so yeah, I would have been 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever when it came out. And this is a movie that my parents actively tried to keep me from watching because it was so violent and stuff. And obviously I saw it anyway, but...
Oh, yeah.
I actually just rented this, I want to say, maybe a year ago on special edition DVD because I wanted to listen to the Scott Mosier and Kevin Smith commentary track on it. That shit was funny. I mean,
I laughed once during the whole thing. I actually enjoyed the Rowdy Harrington track, just seeing how oblivious he mm-hmm. is to what a terrible film he's actually made. I thought that was far funnier.
I don't know. But I don't know. I mean, I thought that Kevin Smith and Scott Mosier just kind of, you know, they really brought the mocking attitude of Roadhouse to its forefront. And I just like those guys.
It was Kevin Smith doing the same three Kevin Smith jokes. I mean, if you really want to see that film mocked properly, the Mike Nelson riff track.
Oh, I can see that.
So you're saying the commentary track by the director is sort of like, have you seen the Masters of the Universe?
I've not heard that one. The best analogy I could make would be Tommy Wiseau talking. Has that actually the guy who made The Room?
Yeah.
Just how oblivious he is to what he's done.
Yeah, this is
watch the Masters of the Universe DVD with the commentary. I mean, that guy thought he was making Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
It is funny to oh my God. Okay, sorry.
Right,
I believe that came up on our favorite commentary.
I think it did. It was an honorable mention.
Yeah.
So I think I've listed all the bad things about this film. Really, the only thing I can say in its defense is I just enjoy other people watching other people's insanity, to being given license to let their own psychological damage be given flight sometimes. So the same way that I can actually watch Zardoz over again, Roadhouse to me is just. It's just who else but a genuine lunatic with about 10, 15 million, 20, or whatever it would have cost back in those days of studio money. How else could this come to be?
Yeah.
Good point.
Okay, for my next one, this is actually, if you think before that people are going to think we did this ahead of time, then they're going to continue thinking that. Because my next movie, all right, have you guys ever watched little kids play, like little 8, 9, 10-year-old kids play?
Yeah.
And they're playing their little gun game, and they go, pew, pew, and the other kids go, you didn't miss me because I'm wearing an invisible bulletproof vest, you know, like the whole thing that they're doing to where they come up with their with their reason why that they get to keep going and why they're doing what they're doing. Well, I'm going to be talking about the cinematic equivalent of that. It's Dogma by Kevin Smith, because he makes so many invisible bulletproof vest things to make this movie not work on the level that it doesn't work. But it's almost fascinating to watch it in its failure, because I thought that Alan Rickman was good, very good in that movie, but he was very much showing up for a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually, I think it's one of the times where I can stand Chris Rock in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just so much shit going on there to where it really does feel like he made that movie to piss people off, to try to get his $100 million movie, and it never did happen. But, you know, you can't take that movie seriously because of the frickin' poop monster, because of the fact that you have an angel named Loki in the goddamn thing, where he actually makes up biblical characters. The fact that you have, like, this, you know, this world-altering thing where the world's going to come to an end, they don't bother bringing Satan into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just these little morons, and I don't know. I like this movie, but I just watched it a week ago, and I'm like, wow, this isn't good. But I still liked it. It was just weird because, you know, he makes those, I don't know if it would be considered a pun or something, but it doesn't feel right, but he makes those leaps of faith in that where he just changes stuff to suit the movie. And it just silly, but at the same time, I like watching it. Have you seen it, Ethan?
Yeah, Dogma?
Yeah.
Okay. I've seen Dogma. I have the special edition DVD.
Yeah. I don't know.
I love their extra features.
Yeah, they're pretty good. They're pretty good. But that's why I picked it, because I think it's preposterous. I think it's silly. But for some reason, I like watching it, and I don't know why. You have anything to add, Christopher?
Well, okay, I have to lay my cards on the table here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my original impression of Kevin Smith was overrated. It the later moved into mild dislike. Then into, just a total eye roll. And now, after his behavior in the London press screening for Red State and his petulant whining.
What did he do in the London press screening?
Well, he basically, he was going to hold a London press screening for most of the leading journalists in England to preview Red State.
Uh-huh.
5 minutes before showtime, he announced to them that all of them, all of which, as far as I know, paid their own way there. He informed them they would not be seeing the film because he had held an online contest among his English fans, and they were going to be watching the movie instead of them. Now,
yeah, that's
up. Yeah, you can say any bad thing you want about modern newspaper journalisms, and you get a fair to middling chance I'm going to agree with you. But that's just being a dick.
Yeah. He's actually been getting pretty obnoxious lately.
Yeah,
and I still listen to a lot of his podcasts.
I think he's just getting old and bitter.
Yep.
And And you know, and he and it's not just that, you know, he was ticking off hacks that were that are gonna hate his movie because, you know, the goodie bag wasn't big enough.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing this to people that actually understand and appreciate cult cinema, guys like Kim Newman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, if I were aiming to make a cult horror film, Kim Newman is like the last person I would ever possibly anger. And really, I'm Facebook friends with Kim Newman, and his utter evisceration of Kevin Smith as this was happening and afterward is just brilliant. I mean, it's like the cinematic equivalent when the guy is like in a sword fight, and you know he like swipes at the candles, and you don't notice till later that he sliced them in half because the wound is so clean and precise. Beautiful, beautiful takedown. Okay, so all right, laying that on the table. Okay, so I'm the point now where I can honestly say I despise every atom of Kevin Smith. The only thing that frightens me more than Kevin Smith is making a new movie is Kevin Smith is making a movie that starts out with a good idea. All that having been said, I think Dogma is a very, 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 very poor film in its execution, but very brave in its conception. So I will give him that sincere, heartfelt credit because being a flavor of Catholic, I'm like, oh wow, somebody's making another movie about my church. Oh, let me guess, we're all going to be hypocritical child molesters. I've never seen this before. But you know, the fact that the basis of the film is the Catholic Church is getting too liberal and moving too far away from its traditional beliefs, that's a daring statement for any filmmaker, Kevin Smith or anybody else you want to throw in there to make. Now, he doesn't have the talent anywhere near able to carry this off. But the fact that that was the starting point on his film, I thought was an incredibly brave choice. And I hate to compare Kevin Smith to Life of Brian, but it was just one of those films that left me utterly baffled about how many people who, you know, profess to have this sincere faith hated the film. And I'm like, look, you may question its quality, but its theology, you know, he agrees with you more than you realize here. So I thought he got a bum ramp on that film. I actually felt some pity for him. Like I said, I wouldn't slow down if he were crossing the street in front of me. But even I felt bad for what he went through on Dogma.
Yeah, I don't know. See, and you're giving it way more thought than I think it deserves. I think it was a bad movie, but I enjoyed it. And that to me is the spirit of this list. I mean, because you know, I mean, to me, he just makes too many departures from what the original message is, to where it's, you know, I'm not even going to go there because I'm not going to pretend to be a theology scholar. But just like some of the stuff that's like on the goddamn surface, you know, it always bothered me that Satan had nothing to do with that whole plot. It always bothered me that he just made up characters when you had so many characters you could have used from the Bible. I mean, it's not like it's copyrighted, but you know, at this, I don't know. And, you know, my thing about Kevin Smith is everything you guys say is right. And I think Kevin Smith is a guilty pleasure of mine. I know that he's a fucking jerk off. I probably know it more than you two guys do because I have listened to 200 plus of his smodcast. I've seen all this stuff happen. You know, I listened to the lead up to Red State of the whole thing where he fucked everyone over at Cannes. I mean, I listened to the lead up to that. Where he's like, "Yeah, I'm going to be auctioning it off. I'm going to be auctioning it off. I'm going to be auctioning it off. We're going to do that." And then you know, I saw him do that, but I don't know. It's just, he is a guilty pleasure of mine. I think he's probably a jerk. He's definitely way arrogant, but I think I understand why. But at the same time, I don't really care that much because he's nothing. You know what I mean? I mean, he's made 9 movies now, I think. And and his top grossing movie was that Bruce Willis movie that sucks so much.
Cop Out.
And it was his top grossing movie by like $3,000. I mean, so it wasn't even like a huge thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people can get all bent out of shape about Kevin Smith, but when it comes down to it, he's a small time player. I mean, he's just not important enough for people to attack him. You know, he doesn't deserve it.
Well, here I think where he bothers people. Is that, you know, if there is such a thing as an emerging geek culture, and I think there certainly is, I think if you feel any solidarity with this hypothetical community, I think you can justifiably resent that he's being trotted out as one of their representatives and one of their spokesperson.
He's trotting himself out there, so it makes it pathetic.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's a whole lot of people out there that do it. Because, you know, I would consider myself a Kevin Smith fan, but I hated Cop Out,
And
oh, yeah. I couldn't even finish Cop Out.
I hated Cop Out. Red State I actually watched twice because I couldn't figure out what to make of it.
Well, now, okay, for somebody that hasn't seen Cop Out, just let me ask you, better or worse than Jersey Girl?
Way worse. I like Jersey Girl, though.
Really?
I like Jersey Girl. Because I thought it was a sweet movie about a father and a daughter.
I didn't think it was bad.
Yeah, but Cop Out was just fucking awful. I mean, it was like an eighties Bruce Willis movie, but it was made in 2010 and it was smugly self aware of what it was. But then it was even worse than any of those movies it was trying to make fun of. But yeah, Red State was just a mess. I think it was, you know, once again, I think he had a lot of ambition for it, but I think he fucked it up. Mm. And, you know, I just don't think that he deserves, I don't think that he deserves these big write-ups. And, you know, I think that he peaked with Clerks. Although I do like Clerks 2 a lot. That's just me. Yeah. But, Ethan, what's your number three?
All right. My number three, getting into movies that I know are bad, but I don't care. It is 1987, directed by Sidney J. Fury, Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
I knew that was going to show up on your list.
It has to. Not only is this the first comic book I ever owned was the comic book version of this movie, but it was also the first movie I remember seeing when I moved to Kansas.
Where'd you see it?
At the Dickinson Theater.
Oh, wow, yeah.
When it came out in 87, I remember going with my dad.
Did your dad like it?
Probably not, you know, I was seven. What do you want? And this movie has always had a very soft spot in my heart because I have fond memories of it as a kid, you know, staying home sick and popping in the VHS mm-hmm. of this movie and just loving it for what it is. And you know, it's Superman, and you know, I'm an 8-year-old, 10-year-old, whatever, that's watching it at that point. And it that sort of joy of this movie has sort of continued on. I know it's bad. I know it's awful. Not as bad as number three. Number three was awful.
Well, you know, it's something that I've noticed. I've got Chloe and I've got the kids around, right? Mm-hmm. It's something I've noticed. It's just so you got to admire about a kid because they will say, you know, what were we talking about? Oh, Kung Fu.
Something.
No, Kung Fu Panda 2. And I asked, Chloe was telling me like that she saw a trailer for Kung Fu Panda 2, and she put that 2 on there as if to say that means it's twice as good. And you gotta love that about kids.
And by that, it's Superman 4.
Yeah, so it's 4 times as good.
Exactly.
I admire that about children because they don't give a fuck if it's good or not. They just care that there's more, uh-huh. And that's what I like about.
Yeah. And this Superman 4 is a movie that's got so many plot holes in it that you could, you know, march an entire third world country through it.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is. I still love it. To this day, I still have it on DVD. Granted, I found it on. It's another one I found on the clearance rack for $2. And I was like, sweet, totally buying that.
I'd buy that for $2.
And in my personal opinion, in my personal experience, this movie gets a lot of shit, and I think it's just unjust. It is bad, but man, there are worse shit out there.
It's an innocent movie.
And this movie is, it's set out to do some things, and, you know, yes, it's got an interesting story behind it. I'd love to see sort of I was depressed when they put out the big Superman special editions. They did a good edition of 1, 2, a crappy one of 3, and then they did shit for number 4. They just did movie in the trailer, and I'm like, come on, I want something, some sort of making of this one, but... Apparently, this is a movie everyone wants to just forget.
It wasn't Richard Lester?
No, it was.
I thought it was.
Lester was stopped on the third one.
I didn't know that.
He did the third one and was done.
Really?
Well, Richard Lester, he was sort of getting ready to retire at that point.
He's getting up there these days.
And as far as I know about this one, Superman 4, it was the rights to it were sold from the Salkins to Canon, I think, the camera company. I think they're a camera Canon. I don't remember.
So
they put this out. And I remember vividly it coming to seeing it at the Dickinson Theaters here in Lawrence, and loving every minute of it as a kid. And that sort of has always translated. You know, 23 years, 25 years later now. that I still love it, and it's still a movie I can sit through and just I've got this big dumbass grin on my face the whole time I'm watching it. So there you go. Superman IV, The Quest for Peace. Say what you will, I still love it. Have you seen that one, Chris? Were you subjected yourself to that one?
Oh yes. Well, you know, I think if you did any traveling at all in the early 90s, if you spent any time in a hotel room and you were just trying to find something to watch so you could fall asleep, mm-hmm. you would invariably hit a Golden Globus film, and that, of course, being one of them.
Yes.
You know, and I caught it trying to doze off at some convention or another, and just found it, you know, to be hypnotically awful.
Yes. I mean, it is such a pretentious movie as far as what it sets out to do.
But in a way, it does sort of have that battle for the Planet of the Apes quality of mm-hmm. that it does have a lot of heart. Nobody involved with the film has the actual skill to carry off successfully. Mm-hmm. But the heart is there. You can't deny it.
And you still get Christopher Reeve as Superman, and that is always...
It's also your last time, right?
It's the last time you saw him, yes, as Superman.
What a way to go.
And this is still, to this day, you know, we've talked about it before, that Christopher Reeve and the role of Superman just, you know, when I was a kid, that was just the ultimate hero for me, you know, was Christopher Reeve as Superman. So this being his last outing and this being... just another, you know, 90 minutes where you could see him be Superman again is always just a treat. So there we go. Superman 4. Christopher, what's your what are we on?
Three.
What is your number three?
All right. Well, I do need to remind everybody, I did warn people that my list would be getting progressively worse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So therefore, number three, I'm going out on a limb here for Teenagers from Outer Space.
Okay.
Yes. Another film... much, much deservedly mocked on Mystery Science Theater, deservedly so. And, oh, Lord, why is this film bad? Bad amateur acting, horrendously terrible dialogue, cheap costumes, cheap special effects, zero budget. But, okay, all right, so here we go. We'll concede every conceivable thing about this film that can be bad is bad. All right, here's what I found in this film. Okay, and to me, if you know a little bit about the making of that film, there is a wonderful meta-narrative tension going on in there. And let me explain. First of all, it tries to paint that idyllic mid-50s small-town setting where everybody knows everybody, everybody likes everybody, everybody's looking out for everybody. And I know that's just as much a myth as anything else. But let's face it, you know, especially for those of us that grew up in a rural setting, it brings back a lot of memories. Because, you know, I mean, even though I realize that that's not a reality, it's a lot closer to my memories of growing up than most other films that I see. So there's an enormously warm, nostalgic feeling that, you know, I think anybody who grew up in a rural setting where, you know, we really didn't know to lock our doors because we thought somebody might walk in and steal something was ridiculous to us. You know, I mean, it has that wonderful small town feel. And the fact that all the actors are amateur community theater players, their amateurishness just really drives home that really small town feel. So here we are. We have what I'm sure hipper critics than me would denounce as a model of 1950s white middle class conformity. But let's throw in the element that gives it its tension. The main character is in the film because he was the gay lover of the guy who wrote and directed this film. So in 1958, this is a love letter between two homosexual lovers. What could be more at odds with 1950s middle class conformity than the love that in that era truly did not speak its name? So on the surface, it's kind of this Valentine to a world that at the same time, the people making this film are living in open defiance of. And if you see these two wonderfully gay and in love men walking around in 1950s America, the contradiction between the two to me is just wonderful. The fact that they were able to get away with that at a time when, you know, it was frankly dangerous to be gay in America. To me, I just can't help but root for those guys, you know, feel some solidarity. I mean, here are some real outsiders in their own really pathetic dime store sci-fi way making an appeal to be accepted as part of what they consider to be the mainstream America that, you know, we all look back on. You know, in a way, and again, in a very amateurish dime store way, it's almost an appeal for tolerance and acceptance years before anybody could discuss these things openly. And yes, I've read way too much into that film. But there you go. I cannot watch that film without getting a little tear in my eye, thinking about my own little rural town, and saying, I salute you two brave but incredibly untalented men.
Oh, man. I have only seen, I think I've seen the MST3K version, and it was a long time ago. And so obviously that sort of colors things. But have you seen it, Aaron?
No.
Nope.
No.
All right.
He wants to now, I bet you.
Probably. Probably.
Well, Aaron, what's your what, number three?
Yeah, my number three is one that, for some reason, my memory is wrong. Yeah, my memory's wrong because I thought it came out a lot longer ago than that. I've talked about it on the show. I'm not going to make any effort to defend it. It's a movie that I just remember like watching. I was going to say I liked it when I was a kid, but I was freaking 16 when it came out, or 15, but it was Batman Forever. I didn't realize that came out in 1995. I would have thought I was like 12 or something. My memories of it are that my sister went to college in Emporia State. And I went down to go hang out with her for like a week or something over the summer. And there was like this little dollar movie theater that was playing Batman Forever. And I think I saw it four times that week with my sister, because she was a big-ass Val Kilmer fan at the time, and probably mm-hmm. still. And there's so much stuff that's wrong about this movie. I'm not going to say there's not. I know that our friend Anthony attacks the shit out of the movie because of the whole part at the end where he says, you know, I'm not Batman because I have to be. It's Batman because I want to be. You know, I say, yeah, they tried something, and it failed epically, but they took a shot, so I give them that. My biggest complaint about the movie is not everyone else's. Everyone else's biggest complaint about the movie is Jim Carrey. I say no. My biggest complaint about it is Tommy Lee Jones as One-Face, or as he's supposed to be known, Two-Face, because he has no internal strife in that movie. But at the same time, I don't know why I like it, but I do. Chris O'Donnell was not a good Robin. I do like Nicole Kidman. Sorry, I do. I've always liked Nicole Kidman. I think Tommy Lee Jones is a good Batman. I'm sorry, a good Bruce Wayne. A shitty Batman, but a good Bruce Wayne. I don't know. I just kind of liked it. So that's my answer.
Fair enough. I don't think I've seen it in over. I probably saw it last more than 10 years ago.
Mm.
And I liked it just fine when it came out, I guess. But you know, obviously, I think what colors people's perception of it is Batman and Robin. The next movie that came out is that colors it so much that they just want to wash their hands of the whole Joel Schumacher era.
Yeah.
The thing I remember about that movie that really I liked was that it had more of a shared universe feel to it, just from the they're halfway to Metropolis by now.
Yeah.
Line, which was I thought fun, because before that, you know, there was no indication that that oh hey, this is the DC universe. Mm-hmm. No, this is just where Batman is.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, this movie definitely movie has its problems.
No, sure,
but yeah.
I will argue anybody to the death that tries to tell me that the Burton movies are flawless, because they are so far from flawless. They're
sure.
Very flawed as far as I'm concerned, but I don't know. I don't care. I don't own this. I don't need to own this. I'd probably think about it if I saw it for $2 on DVD, but I remember liking it as a kid, and it's like I will destroy the 89 Batman with any, you know, I do not like that movie. I cannot stand Batman Returns. Batman and Robin, I think, is bad. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say it isn't bad, because it's bad. But I think the people that attack it don't get it, because
sure.
they were trying to do what they did. I mean, it is what it is. But Batman Forever is the one that – it's just the one that I don't particularly care to attack, because I just have a fond memory of it from my sister. So,
cool.
Have you seen it, Christopher?
Oh, yeah. I was rooming with one of my all-time best friends, Skip Morton, and he was a radio DJ at the time, and he was able to finagle that into two free passes for us to go see it. And Skip, in addition to being one of my all-time favorite friends, he's a unique guy. he's into the Batman mythos simply because he's into Robin and the Riddler. You know, Batman is sort of a supporting character in his conception of that universe.
I am a big fan of Dick Grayson.
Yeah, well, so is he. And Tim Drake. He would kill me if I didn't mention that. But anyway, you know, so we wound up going on opening night for free. And, you know, my short review is, this is the only film I've seen for free and still felt ripped off. But I will say this much. Something that occurred to me as you were talking about this film, and that is really the fact that I think timing is everything. Mm-hmm. If that had been the first Bat film, I think we would remember it a lot more fondly than we do.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
it had the misfortune of following the Burton films, which Aaron's opinion, not disregarding it, but I'm just thinking most people were pretty happy with the first two Bat films. Mm-hmm. Again, that doesn't.
I'm okay with people being happy with them in 1989,
I'm not saying they're right. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying the vast majority of people who made the first Burton film at the time, the most successful film ever made, seemed to be pretty happy with that take on the character. So I think Schumacher may have suffered more than anything else from following not only that, but let us not forget that by the time the Schumacher film comes out, they've also done Batman the Animated Series. And if you want to say anything bad about Batman the Animated Series, the stick is going down and the gloves are coming off.
No, I won't. Okay? No, that showed up as my favorite television show of all time when we did that show.
All right. All right. God bless you.
That's the Lost show, though.
The Lost show, yeah, that's
the
right.
Lost episode.
You know, the simple fact that you could have taken any episode of the Animated Series, you know, or any two of them, you know, maybe written some connecting material and come up with an infinitely better film than Schumacher delivered, I think it really suffered in comparison to that. I mean, there were just so many better takes on that character out there. I think it really suffered from that regard.
Yeah. I do think that this one, it made a lot of money.
Oh yeah,
and a lot of people are like, it was pretty good, but the other ones were better. That was pretty much the way people reacted to it when it came out. And they've retrospectively, like, that movie fucking blows because of the Nolan movies. And I don't really think that's fair. And the only thing I'm gonna and what I was my point about the Batman, about the 89, and especially Batman Returns. If you look at some reviews of Batman Returns, people hated that movie. They attacked that movie. But my thing about Batman 89. I'm fine with everybody liking it as much as they did when it came out. My thing about it is, you watching it in 2012, it looks like a movie that was made in 1985, even though it was made in 1989. And I'm just amazed that a Batman movie doesn't hold up better than it does.
Yeah, and for me, sort of looking back, the sort of notion I get now, and as when I was a kid, all that time, is that it sort of looked to me as that Hollywood and producers and people who weren't really that intelligent were paying a lot of attention to the Batman movies, but not paying attention to the animated series.
Right.
They're like, yeah, do whatever you want with the cartoon. We're going to go focus on something that's going to make us a big dump truck of money. And that made the animated series that much better.
Well, you know, and people love to throw that argument out there. They love to do that.
Yeah, the animated series so much better. Fuck these movies.
But you know what? No, that's not a. I don't think that's fair because they put out Mask of the Phantasm in the theater and it fucking tanked.
Yeah,
nobody went and saw it.
But it got zero promotion. Let's not forget that.
I saw it in the theater. I heard of it. They promoted it through the television show.
Oh, how many films are we gonna hear about that the vast majority of the moviegoers are gonna miss?
But what I'm saying is the people that love to tout the television show are the people that are watching the television show, and they didn't go either.
I went and saw it in theaters.
I did,
Christmas
too.
Day,
I loved it. Yeah, it came out on Christmas Day.
I think what probably factors into that is the adults that did like Batman and Batman Returns, or the mass audience, weren't really watching the TV show.
And let's not forget, that was, what, 94? It was, you know, you still
something
were going to
Mask of the Phantasm?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, you weren't going to drag many adults to a cartoon at that point.
Yeah.
But those same adults now who are
the
45 or whatever.
And the TV show, on the TV show, the animated series, it was moderately successful.
It was really successful, the TV series.
It was a fight to keep it on the air, though.
Yeah, that's true. But the first season was really successful. I do remember that. But, you know, I don't know. My thing about it, that's my point, is I'm not defending this movie at all, but I just liked it because I saw it with my big sister because she had a crush on Val Kilmer. Mm-hmm. That's my defense of it, and that's all I'm going to give it.
Sure. And a very sweet one it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Ethan, what's your number two?
Oh, okay. My number two is a guilty pleasure, and it's I'm hard pressed to explain why. It is a bad movie. It is not typically the type of movie that I go for. It's the 1997 Volcano.
I knew that was coming up on your list.
Yeah, you knew it had to be on here. I own this on DVD. I recognize that it's bad.
That's
I recognize
awful.
How awful this movie is. But I don't know why I like it.
I don't know why you like it either.
I just watched it not too long ago, and I still like it. Explaining it, it's one of those just I can't really put my finger on. It's like, well, I like the gravitas of the kid. No, it's none of that. I mean, it's a disaster movie about a volcano erupting in Los Angeles, for Christ's sake. I generally don't go in for disaster movies. And I just liked this one.
An apt disaster movie.
And I know you hate it. That's fine. That's great.
You said it's 97?
97. And so I cannot I cannot say this is definitively why
was
I like
this
after
movie. Dante's Peak?
It was before? Around the same time.
Yeah, I do know that. But it's not important. Here's my thing about this movie. I saw this movie.
Dante's Peak was in 97 as well.
Okay. I saw this movie in 97 when it came out, and you know, yeah, the whole scene at the end where, hey, look, everybody looks the same, made me want to just punch everybody in the face of the theater. But I was not as nearly as big of a film snob as I am now, and I hated that movie. Mm-hmm. And so I had gone since 1997.
Volcano came out 2.5 months after Dante's Peak.
And I saw Dante's Peak, and that sucked too.
Yeah,
but
well, yeah.
I did not see this movie again until just a few months ago. Rachel wanted to see it, and I was flabbergasted at how fucking awful it was. I thought I was just being a 17-year-old film snob who thought I had to hate every movie that came out. Good Lord, is it bad.
And say what you will, you know, you fucking hate it, that's great. I cannot definitively explain to you in detail why I like this movie. I just do. It is...
I'm not asking you to, but
still watch it, and I'm still entertained. I recognize that it's awful. I recognize that there's so many bad things in it that it is a cliched, you know, cookie cutter disaster flick.
Disaster,
and, you know,
is right.
And I didn't like Dante's Peak. I'm not a fan of really any disaster movies that are out there. They're just not good. And I don't know why this one sort of spoke to me. It just did. And you hate it. 99% of the people out there hated it. I liked it just fine. So that's why it reached number two on my list.
I knew it was going to be on your list.
I recognize that,
this is
there are people that it makes them vomit convulsively.
Well, I'm not even there. It's just really bad. But you know, that's your mantra on the show. Like, yeah, but what do I know? I own a copy of Volcano.
Pretty much. I mean, I recognize that this is bad, and that it's like yes, I say Seven Samurai is the best movie ever, but hey, I'm a guy who also owns a copy of Volcano.
But I just remember
and
watching
chose
it.
To purchase it, you know. So
I remember watching it just a few months ago. I'm like, oh my God, this is so
but
bad.
I think there's one movie. Everyone's got a movie like that
somewhere
of. Everybody hates it, but for some reason, some unknown, strange, the universe is wired weirdly, you like it. And this, for me, it's this movie. And I don't know. I don't know why. I just do. So there you go. Volcano 97 with Tommy Lee Jones.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've seen that one, Christopher?
I actually do have a story to share about it, despite having not seen it.
Okay.
My memory of this film is... It stems from a show that probably nobody else remembers. It used to air on the old Sci-Fi Channel back before it became SIFI or whatever they're calling it nowadays.
Syphilis, sure.
That they're showing wrestling and things like that.
Yes.
They used to have a show on there called Sci-Fi Vortex, and they would always end with a debate segment, and they would actually
criticize... I remember that show. Okay, yeah.
God bless you. They would actually have a debate segment where they would actually criticize other shows on the Sci-Fi Channel and films being released by the Universal. I think they owned the channel at the time. Mm. So, of course, you know, they were canceled pretty darn fast.
Well, yeah.
But there was one guest on there, and God knows, I wish I could remember who this was. You know, they brought up the topic of Volcano because it was coming out. They figured they might as well mention it. And this guy said, much to the disbelief of everybody else sitting there, and he goes, "This is the future of movie making. This is a film where one or two name actors will fight a green screen at the cost of about $100, $150 million. It will turn a tidy profit, and nobody who's seen it will remember it 5 minutes after it's over. And Hollywood will continue to make more and more and more of these. And at the time, I was like, no. But, you know, honestly, the more I've thought about that, you know, the more I look at, well, what's coming out this summer? This guy, I mean, he seems as prophetic as any media critic I have ever come across. And like I said, I wasn't even paying close enough attention to remember the guy's name. But just, you know, the fact that he's, I think, pretty accurately singled out Volcano as the future of movies. You know, that's given the film sort of a really creepy edge for me, just, you know, to my tastes.
I know that I read a Roger Ebert's review of it, because, like, I was just fascinated with how bad this movie was when I watched it. This is the second time, and I read Roger Ebert's review, and he was really kind of kind about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the, he's like, it has great effects, and I'm like, and I'm sitting here, and it was 2011, and I'm like, I was trying to really look at a 1997 movie, and I started looking at other 1997 movies, and no, it did not have great effects, even in 1997. And I mean, I probably went through like a day and a half of being fascinated with how bad that movie was, but not in the Troll 2 kind of way, because I didn't enjoy it at all. It was just, I was just like, wow.
And like I keep saying, I cannot explain it to you.
But we can agree to hate that one movie that sucked too, The Day After Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, that was.
Gosh. That was
just bad.
No, that was bad. I think this is just as bad, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Christopher, what's your number two?
All righty. Well, again, we're getting progressively worse. And here I have a film so bad, even its creator has utterly disowned it. And
directed by Alan Smithy?
No. He starred in it, so he couldn't run that far away from it. But I'm referring to the justifiably little seen 1980 The Gong Show movie.
I like that movie.
Oh, God, you've seen
it? Of course I've seen The Gong Show movie. I liked that movie.
Nobody's seen this movie in 30 years, and you're like, of course I've seen it?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's one of those movies that always pops up on those horrible movies that nobody's ever seen. When I saw it, I had to find it.
Oh,
yeah.
God, sir.
I like Chuck Bears.
What's the title again?
The Gong Show movie.
Okay.
Well, first of all, let's concede its faults. It's based off of what is a monument to utter bad taste. Mm-hmm. It's a forerunner of the reality shows that are killing not only popular culture, but the culture at large. And in fact, a good chunk of the movie is stuff that was considered to be too bad to air on the actual Pretty Bad TV show. But it's the linking stories that they've built in and around it that I think make it a compulsively watching movie. And the plot of the film, such as it is how basically Chuck Barris, the host and creator of The Gong Show, how his life has become utter hell. He's become a complete and utter prisoner of his success because he can't go anywhere without people either going like, oh, you're the monster who made that horrible television show. Or every single untalented person in America is obsessively stalking him, trying to show him their lack of talent in a desperate bid for fame and attention. And it's like a man who can't live with the horrible face of our already broken society in this desperate quest for attention, fame, and validation, which, of course, has only gotten worse in the age of Snooki. And he winds up having a total breakdown to the point where he just goes to an airport, asks for a ticket to Morocco, and just wanders out in the middle of the desert to die. But, you know, not to spoil too much of it, but, you know, his wonderful gang of wacky friends, everybody from Gene the Dancing Machine to the Unknown Comic, band together to save him in the desert with a musical number.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's just, it's got wonderful things to say. It's got insightful things to say about our culture. It's a genuinely personal statement, which, you know, obviously I've expressed a fondness for. And again, okay, while we're all getting to name personal reasons we like a movie, if you take the bare plot of that, you pretty much have the last year of my life. You have a guy being completely and utterly being a victim and nearly destroyed by his previous success, only to be saved by his wonderfully wacky and understanding friends. And by the way, I would count both of you guys in that number. So let me publicly thank you guys for helping me not give up on life in the last year and keeping me sane and giving me a reason to go on. And I love you guys.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice of you to say.
You guys deserve it, man.
I'm glad that we were able to be some solace at all.
Oh, you guys were, getting on here to react about movies, that helped keep me sane, so thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry, I was taking a drink.
Always happy to keep someone sane.
You've earned it.
was just so Coke, but.
So there you go, Gong Show movie. Check it out.
I have seen it. It was one of those movies where I don't even remember. I think it was you cannot believe this movie exists. And I watched it. And I'm all like, that was really unique.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really unique. It was a cool movie. I liked it. We're on to my number two. Yes, we're on my number two. My number two is, I would imagine Ethan might think this might show up on my list. It showed up in multitudes of lists that I've done, and I don't remember the year, I don't remember the director, hell, I don't even remember which chapter it is, but it's Friday the 13th, Jason Lives. It's not good, but it's a different kind of not good than the rest of the Friday the 13th movies. Ethan grew
number
up...
number six, I think, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, six, because... Yeah. Because four was
it's,
the
it's
last
one with the bloody smiley face, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Four was the final chapter. Then five was the new beginning. Then six was Jason Lives, and seven was a new beginning. And then eight was Manhattan. Nine was Goes to Hell.
Uh-huh.
10 was Jason X, and 11 was
versus Jason,
and then the fucking remake that didn't happen. Ethan grew up on his Schwarzenegger movies. I grew up on my Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm amazed I've developed such a palette for movies that I have now growing up on bullshit like this. Because I watched every one of the Friday the 13th movies multiple times. Like the Friday the 13th Final Chapter, which I will still say is a good movie to this day, the Final Chapter. I had a copy of that on VHS, and I spent like freaking $40 on it back in the day when VHSs were expensive. I watched that fucker until it broke. And it's also got one of the best movie posters ever. It's the Jason's mask with the knife in the eye hole. But anyway, we're not talking about that one. We're talking about the one that turned Jason into the mockery that he turned into.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the first one, it's his mom. The second one, it's Jason somehow, but a suspension of misbelief, he was somewhere and he got out. But he barely lives through that one. Third one, he just barely lives through. Fourth one, there ain't no fucking way he's living through it. No way, because he gets his head chopped in half and he gets cut up into 100 million pieces. Next one, it's an imposter. And so, like, oh shit, these movies are making money. How do we bring them back? Lightning, done. And then, you know, that's probably how it happened. They're probably
I wonder if the people making the I Am Legend sequel know about that one.
Hey, yeah, there we go.
Yeah. And this is the point where Jason became a golem, pretty much.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's just a flesh golem. But, you know, I just like this movie because it's so... And this is one that I almost don't want to call it a bad movie because it's not like any of the other Friday the 13th movies by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
Because it's...
It's
fun.
Very tongue-in-cheek.
Very tongue-in-cheek. It's the one where the sleeping bag scene came from, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah.
There was a scene when somebody tries to shoot Jason with a paintball gun, for Christ's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
There's the scene where he chokes that chick in the puddle of water on the floor, and she's trying to pay him off so he doesn't do it, and then they have the nerve to have that American Express card just float across the screen, just, you know, just begging you to scream out, never leave home without it. It has the James Bond-esque barrel scene, but with Jason, where he chops the person. And I don't know, I just kind of like it. I mean, it's just, I loved Friday the 13th when I was a kid. I mean, this is like almost the quintessential guilty pleasure for me, because I know these are not good, but I just like them. And this is one I've showed Ethan, and he liked it. So
yeah, it was cheesetastic. Yeah.
Have you seen that one, Christopher?
I honestly, they started to blend together for me after a while. But I can say something about the whole about most of the whole series, and I think maybe six we can include in this trend. The thing that I appreciate about those movies is they are some of the last gasp of true drive-in cinema. They're films that are being sold as, come see this because they don't want you to see it.
Yeah, I will absolutely.
I always appreciated how they, you know, there were a lot of, they eventually just fell victim to the same mainstream thing that the Nightmare on Elm Street series succumbed to a lot sooner, where they're basically asking you to root for the ostensible villain. But certainly early on in the series, you know, it had that wonderful outsider drive-in con, you know, come see this thing that, you know, you're not supposed to see. You know, granted, you know, the fact that they're cheap, they're poorly acted, they're poorly written, poorly directed, but you're going to see something, you know, out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that there was at least some attempt to keep that aspect of drive-in cinema alive, and I appreciate that aspect of it.
Here's my thing about it, is I don't, and you are 100% right, I hate the fact that people like to group Freddy Krueger and Jason together. I've never liked it because I didn't think that it was fair to do that to Friday the 13th. Because Friday the 13th didn't become a joke. In my experience, in my honest opinion, Friday the 13th did not truly become a joke until Jason X. And I still like Jason X because it was just absolutely absurd. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I'm, you know, because it's not Friday the 13th anymore. Because after part 7, there were no longer Friday the 13th because they switched companies. And, you know, so to me, I can disassociate that. By the third Nightmare on Elm Street movie, they become a joke. And the second, the second,
you might argue the second one.
The second one is almost. It's almost like the frickin' it's almost like the Halloween movie with where it's actually the haunted toys. It just does not fit because it's just the main character is just so weird and homoerotic, and he's actually doing all the killing, and it's a clunky fit. But it's not as absurd as the third one, or the fourth one, or the fifth one. And I don't know. I like the Friday the 13th movies for what they were. And I will, if we ever do an exploitation movie, I will put Friday the 13th Part 4 on there. Because I do think the Friday the 13th Part 4 is one of the last exploitation movies ever made. I mean, it's I do enjoy that one. I would like to get that poster on my wall at some point, but... I like Friday the 13th, and maybe I should apologize for it, but I'm not going to because I like it. So at this point, we're down to Ethan's number one.
Numero uno.
Numero uno.
Okay. This is a movie, again, harkens back to my childhood of watching this. And, you know, again, because I mentioned it earlier in the show, is the Disney Channel. This movie I remember watching on the Disney Channel, and I only recently, within the last few years, rediscovered it. And I loved it when I was a kid, and I still love it today. My number one is the 1981, directed by Charles Gerrott, Condor Man.
Never heard of it.
Oh, wow.
Condor Man?
Condor Man. Yes, yes. And Condor Man makes a very, Condor Man in toy form makes a cameo in a recent Pixar animated short.
Oliver Reed, Michael Crawford.
Yep, Michael Crawford, Oliver Reed.
Like that Condor Man?
Yes.
Really?
Uh-huh.
I didn't know it was a movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's why I saw when I saw it in that short, in that Pixar short, Toy Story short, I just had to clap because it was Condor Man. And I was like, that's a real movie. But Condor Man is a, you know, obviously way early 80s from musical legend, or Broadway legend, Michael Crawford, doing, a superhero movie that, you know, was an original sort of a superhero / James Bond movie, where he plays a cartoonist, a comic book artist, who draws this series called Condor Man. His friend works for the CIA. Well, he gets, basically keeps bugging his friend to help let him go on a mission, and he does, gets caught up in this, this whole big thing with Oliver Reed as the bad guy, and you have a villain in there who has a silver eye. And you've got Oliver Reed being sinister and dastardly, and he gets the funding he needs and builds all this Condor Man stuff that he wants. So he gets this awesome car that turns into a boat, and it is such a cornball movie that's got a great scene where he rescues the damsel and then flies off with her with his Condor Man suit. And it is such a movie that is aged so poorly from the 1980s. but I still look back with reverence and love to this movie. It is just so cornball and so innocent and unapologetic as to what it is. And it really is a Disney Bond movie. And you have just these great sort of set pieces, you know, great car chases. You got the awesome car. I mean, it is a movie made for a little kid to love. So there you have it. It is
everything
my,
I'm looking at. It looks like it'd be something I might like.
There you have it. Well, they put it out on DVD briefly, and then it's Disney, so immediately went out of print, and then it became hard to find.
Mm.
But it is the 1981 Condor Man. So there you have it. I know, Aaron, you haven't seen it. Do you even know of this one, Christopher?
I am passingly familiar with it, but honestly, as you were talking about it, it really took me back to a time I'd forgotten, because that's a time, I mean, Disney is almost the world's lone superpower at this point.
Yes.
And, but, you know, I mean, that was a time when, you know, the studio was in financial trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They had tried, I think, like Herbie Goes to Jonestown to try to get people to see their movies.
Yep.
And, like, Disney was completely not connecting with their audience. They were even having trouble getting their films into theaters.
Yep.
I mean, that's a film I remember reading about in Starlog, but, I mean, it never came within any drivable distance of where I lived at the time, and it just sort of slipped completely under the cracks. And, you know, the thought that a Disney film, that could ever happen to a Disney film, it's just so incredible. But wow, I'm just stunned. That was a real deep draw from the memory hole for me.
It is a movie that is just words don't sort of describe how nostalgic this movie is for me, and because it really is a Bond movie, but made by Disney, and it's totally cheeseball, and you have just some great moments in the movie. It really doesn't take itself that seriously, but it's serious enough to not be, too campy, that sort of thing. So I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy this movie. I highly recommend anyone go out and check it out. I'm sure it's incredibly hard to find nowadays. I do have a copy of it in one shape or form. So, but I mean, you're talking about watching a movie on video and killing the hell out of it. So, I mean, and I did, that's pretty much what we did, and we had it recorded off of the Disney Channel. So, and this was back when the Disney Channel didn't have commercials.
I remember those days, yeah.
So, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, so this movie, I mean, fantastic for me, so. Condor Man.
Yep. Very good. Christopher, number one.
Alrighty, well, I had number one by my own criteria is, of course, the most reviled movie on my list, and I think it's no contest as far as being the most despised film on my list, because, I mean, you look at the other stuff I've come up with, you know, if Teenagers from Outer Space doesn't turn out to be the next Citizen Kane, or, you know, the guy who made The Gong Show doesn't deliver a cinematic classic, you kind of can only be so surprised from that. But number one is a terrible film from one of the all-time great directors, and that is Sam Peckinpah's 1978 film Convoy.
I like that movie, though.
And for those that weren't around in 1978, I mean, this would be like Martin Scorsese taking over the next Transformers film, because it's based off on a nearly forgotten novelty song, which, you know, might arguably be one of the first rap songs, but it's basically a guy spouting CB lingo, you know, good buddy, trucker, you know, for a good 3 or 4 minutes. And this is sort of the cinematic adaptation of that. And, you know, the guy who gave us The Ballad of Cable Hogue and The Wild Bunch and Ride the High Country doing something based off a novelty song. I mean, it's just such an unspeakably depressing proposition on its face. Throw in the fact the script wasn't finished. Sam was drinking heavily, even by Sam Peckinpah baseline standards. He had to have his good friends Ernest Borgnine and Chris Christopherson direct major portions of it just to get it filmed on time. You know, and you are, I mean, it's a just, I mean, it's as big a mess as you might think it is. But here's the thing. The fact that Peckinpah chose to work with actors he'd had great success with before, like Christopherson and Borgnine, they knew enough of the Peckinpah themes that he loved to insert into his films, that if you look beyond the fact that it's a mess, and B, it's based off a novelty song, there is a solid Peckinpah narrative running underneath it. And it's basically a redo of his vastly underrated film, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
That is actually my favorite of Peckinpah's movies, I've argued with Ethan about it before. I do love The Wild Bunch.
It's a good movie. I love The Wild Bunch more, but
I think the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid's the better movie, and I love The Wild Bunch, though. But,
well, Convoy is sort of like its evil twin that gets justifiably...
I've seen Convoy. I went through a Peckinpah phase at one point, and I chased it down, and
I watched it. I liked it quite a bit, and then I started reading like all the attacks on it. I was like, "Holy shit!" I didn't really think it deserved what it got.
Yeah. Well, once you start reading the film as Ernest Borgnine's character, seeing Kris Kristofferson as the younger version of himself, mm-hmm. and this metaphorical attempt to murder his younger, better self, it takes on a whole new life.
Right.
And here's the other reason I will defend this, and I will have to admit, this is something that I got from the Convoy fan site. Apparently, this film is huge over in Germany and actually gets critical respect over there. The film accidentally makes a fantastic statement about mass political movements, because the film opens up, is based off Kristofferson and a few of his buddies fleeing a bogus trumped-up police charge in Arizona and making a run for it, and them being joined by the convoy of the title. And the governor of New Mexico, starts misinterpreting it as a political movement and starts to see, how can I politically exploit this guy who, as Kris Kristofferson said, I'm just running for my life. And there's this great scene where the governor's aide is trying to talk to the other truckers, trying to find the political subtext of this movement. And every single trucker they talk to has a different political gripe of varying degrees of validity or just out-and-out conspiracy craziness. And every one of them assumes that their particular idea is what the entire movement is about. And that could be used to describe so many different political movements throughout history and in contemporary politics. It's everybody trying to find something that connects with them on some level, and then to a degree deluding themselves that, oh, yes, well, they're 100% speaking out for my own personal views on things. And that great accidental commentary on the mob mentality and how it relates to politics, I think it's a valuable message wrapped up in a film that is an absolute stink burger.
Okay.
So there you go.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's I always thought it was too attacked. I mean, I can see it. I mean, obviously it doesn't hold up with most of his movies, but I didn't think it's nearly as bad as it's made out to be. But you know, that might be it.
Mostly in comparison. It suffers mostly in comparison.
Yeah, unfortunately that happens an awful lot. You've not seen this one, Ethan?
No, I have not.
It's a good one. It's a good one. I like it. It is a good one. Getting onto my list, my number one, I wouldn't imagine that this would come as much of a surprise to Ethan, but I chose The Phantom Menace. The Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. Okay, something that I need to point out with all my movies that I picked, there's not a one of these that I'm going to argue is a good movie. And the reason why I did not put the whole prequel trilogy in here is because I think that that with their faults, episodes 2 and 3 mostly suffer because of The Phantom Menace. I mean, I'm hardly calling them, you know, fantastically, wonderfully great movies or anything, but I think that they do suffer in comparison with The Phantom Menace, because The Phantom Menace is not a good movie. It is not a good movie. One of my biggest problems with it is the pacing. There's a lot of bullshit happening that you just don't care about. They spend an awful long time on spaceships looking bored. They spend probably too much time on Tatooine, although I liked the pod race. I thought it was kind of cool. I kind of liked the Darth Maul and Qui-Gon and Ewan McGregor fight at the end of it, but it looked like a screensaver because it was just too CGI of a fight for my taste. Although there was some cool shit in it. I mean, sure. I've said before 100. I think I said on our sword fight show that after Qui-Gon's killed and Obi-Wan makes it through the door and Obi-Wan and Darth Maul are fighting and he cuts his saber in half, and then I think that like that little like 10-15 second part of that fight there is really freaking cool. I thought that was really cool, but I mean, there's 20 minutes before that isn't good. Mm-hmm. My thing about it is, I absolutely 100% understand everybody's gripes about Jar Jar Binks, but I'm not a person that would jettison him. If like say that George Lucas says, Aaron, you're right, you should remake this movie for me, and he says, I'll give you $100 billion, or hell, I'll give you $2 million to make a
you know, your own version of the Phantom Menace using all of our footage. I would actually not replace Jar Jar Binks. I would probably redo his voice, because I think that's what annoys me about it. I think that other people are just too quick to chop off the arm to get rid of the finger ache, so to speak. Because I think that that's like the worst thing about him is his voice, and maybe get rid of one or two of the poop jokes. But one of the things I kind of actually do like Jar Jar Binks, although his voice annoys me. I kind of like the fact that, and Obi-Wan says it earlier in the movie, where he says, "Did we pick up another pathetic life form?" And yeah, that's kind of exactly the whole point of him. Because they weren't able to bring C-3PO along with them, because he had to stay on the planet, so they had something to do in the second one, I guess. But so there was just R2-D2. You didn't have anything to play it off of, so you needed to have, like, because you have your space fucking wizards, and you have your your intergalactic queens, and you got all these crazy characters, and I kind of like the whole idea of, like, the dumbass, lowly peasant character, kind of like, you know, a la Hidden Fortress kind of things going on there. And like I said, I like the pod race. It was kind of cool. One of the things that I've never, ever, 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 ever understood about the criticisms of this movie is Natalie Portman is fucking awful in this movie. She should be thrown through a wood chipper through this movie. She should be beaten to death with her Oscar because of the performance in this movie. And I've never understood. Everybody attacks every fucking thing about that movie, but never her. And I don't get it. I don't get it. Sofia Coppola won a fucking Razzie for her performance in that movie, and she was standing in the background, and nothing because of Natalie Portman. I don't get it. It's like she's made out of Teflon. Nobody ever calls her on her shit. She's an awful fucking actress, and I thought that she was going to ruin the trilogy. I still think she's worse than Hayden Christensen. I don't care. I will argue anyone with that. She sucked in that one, and she sucked even worse in the other ones, and I don't know. But this is a movie that it's not a good movie. I'm not going to say it is. I'm not going to say it didn't rape my childhood, because fuck you. My childhood was cool. And you can't rape my childhood with a movie that came out when I was 19, you know? So it's my number one. It's my number one because I think it shouldn't come across as any surprise to Ethan. But I almost put the prequel trilogy in there, but I won't call this two or three of bad movies. Maybe they're not great, but they're not bad. Phantom Menace, pretty bad. Pretty boring, definitely.
Sure.
So that's my number one. Thoughts?
My sort of stance on the movie is long since cataloged.
No, it isn't. Not the Phantom Menace.
No, Phantom Menace. It's not as bad a movie as people put it out to be. It is what it is. I enjoy it just fine. Yes, there's the whole people get all bent out of shape over Jar Jar Binks, and I think people need to get over it and move on. I can still watch it and enjoy it. Sure. So, hey, whatever.
It is what it is. Thoughts, Christopher?
You know, my main thing about that is, it is, if I can explain this, it's a frighteningly bad film. And let me explain what I mean by frightening. The thing about it is, this film's main critics, they seem to be the victims of like a Stockholm syndrome. Because it's like the people that I hear denouncing this film the most... If you can stop them long enough to say, so are you going to go out and get them the third time they're re-released on DVD? Of course. Are you going to pay another 10, 15 bucks to go see it in 3D? Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's just the fact that these films are supposed to be that bad, and yet people keep lining up the block to see around the block to see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was there something going on there? It doesn't seem to be particularly healthy or constructive, but... Something scary bad going on there.
Yeah, I don't think it hurts anyone. That, you know, that's one of my things is something I'm noticing, especially like the older that I get, is, you know, my criticism is I don't see it. You know, if I watched episode one and I thought it was that fucking awful, I would have been seen two or three no matter how good I heard they were. Because I've heard people try to tell me the Transformers movies are... You know, better, like the two and three are better than the first one, but I don't care. I didn't like the first one. And I've never understood the fact that people would rather see a movie and bitch about it than not see it and say nothing about it. To me, silence is kind of more powerful, personally. But, okay, I guess that's going to bring us to an end of our list. Ethan, are you ready for your rundown?
I am ready for my rundown. Starting at number 10, it's the 1975 Doc Savage, The Man of Bronze.
That's my number 10 as well.
Wow.
This is my number
yeah,
two.
Yeah, I introduced
what
you to
are
that
the
movie.
Odds?
I love that movie, though.
Oh, and it's bad.
It's bad, but it's, I still really, really, really yeah. like it.
My number nine is, I guess this probably would be the one I would defend as far as the screw you, I liked it. It's the 2005 Constantine.
I haven't seen it, but I don't care to.
Hey, I liked it.
And there you go. I'm not going to go see it and say, you're fucking wrong. I'm going to not see it and say, I'm glad you like it, Ethan.
Number eight, 1997, Con Air. Yeah.
I like Con Air.
So did I.
I like The Rock better.
My number seven is the 2004 Alien versus Predator. Then we get into number six, Robot Jocks. Number five, Hercules Unchained. Number four, Commando. Number three, Superman IV, The Quest for Peace. Number two, Volcano. And number one, Condor Man, which incidentally I've just discovered is you can watch it on Amazon Instant Watch for $2.
That much, huh?
Yes. And was apparently based on a Robert Sheckley novel.
Cool. Christopher, what's your list look like?
Well, for number 10, I went with the Burt Reynolds, Liza Minnelli, Gene Hackman misfire Lucky Lady.
Okay.
Again, my reasons for liking it are complex, but it's not as bad as they say. I'll leave it at that. Number nine, the inexplicably popular and much beloved by me, hippie, peace, butt-kicking, martial art, Green Beret, Billy Jack.
I like Billy Jack. Billy Jack's cool. A lot of people like that movie, man.
I adore it. Just don't ask me why.
A lot of people do.
Yeah, and they're scary. as a rule, they're scary. I may be one of them. Number eight is the classic Sun Classic Pictures crocumentary In Search of Noah's Ark. Number seven is, all the people that think Gene Roddenberry is solely success for the success of Star Trek, I would point them in the direction of his other auteur vision, Pretty Maids All in a Row.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you haven't seen it, you really, really, really need to do it to get a real peek inside the mind of the father of Star Trek. And then we're back to number six, The Incredible Melting Man. Number five, Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Four, Roadhouse. Three, Teenagers from Outer Space. Two, The Gong Show Movie. And number one, Convoy.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you.
My number 10 is Doc Savage, Man of Bronze. My number nine is, it's Cutthroat Island. I probably like it less now that I saw Pirates of the Caribbean, but it came out, I was like, it's kind of a cool pirate movie. But I still kind of like it. My number eight is Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. Not a good movie, but I still think it's funny. And I'm not a pothead, and I don't particularly care one way or the other about stoner comedies. But this is one I kind of liked. It kind of had its funny moments. The sequel is god awful, but I liked the third one, Harold and Kumar's Very Merry Christmas. It was kind of funny. It had some dumbass moments in it, but I liked the third one way better than I liked the second one. Then my number seven. This is one I actually might have to explain myself on, but it is, I don't remember the year, probably 2008, 2009, the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes. Because, since then I've realized it sucks. I mean,
I like it.
I do too. But my thing about it is I remember when Christopher got all pissy about us liking Star Trek. And he said, why couldn't they just put an extreme orbital jump in, some other movie? To me, this Sherlock Holmes movie is putting extreme orbital jumps in a Sherlock Holmes movie. Because they had to have all that over-the-top kind of action and stuff. When Sherlock Holmes, while he can throw down, he's mostly an intellectual character. Mm-hmm. But, they had to show him kicking ass and taking names.
All right, but as long as I'm coming up with at least semi-valued reasons for my opinions, let's not call that getting pissy.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay,
I'll edit that out. With Christopher coming up with his semi-valid reasons for the orbital jumping.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go.
Semi-valid in all things.
Okay. And then we get into the list we've already discussed. It's Scott Pilgrim versus the World. What was my five? Oh, it was Troll 2. My number four was Dogma. And my number three was Jason Lives. What the hell just happened? My number three was... No, I'm sorry. My number three was... My four was Dogma. Okay, I'm sorry. Let's do this again. My six is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. My five was... Troll 2. My
4 was Dogma. My 3 was Batman Forever. My 2 was Jason Lives. My number 1 was The Phantom Menace. And I thought that was a lot of fun because obviously, you know, there's not a whole lot of argument to be going on with a movie where we're all walking in with our, you know, with our souls bare. Like, yeah, this sucks, but I like it anyway.